those stern, dark eyes focused on Nynaeve. I am the Ammerlin's seat, girl. Do you not know how to show respect? I will have you... In mid-word, she was gone. Nynaeve exhaled raggedly. Elida as Ammerlin. That was a nightmare for certain. Probably her fondest dream, she thought wryly. It will snow in Tyr before she ever rises that high. The anteroom was much as she remembered it, with one wide table and a chair behind it for the Keeper of the Chronicles. A few chairs sat against the wall for Aes Sedai waiting to speak with the Ammerlin. Novices and accepted stood. The neat array of papers on the table, bound scrolls and large parchments with seals and letters, seemed unlike Lyanna, though. Not that she was untidy, quite the reverse, yet Nynaeve had always thought she would put everything away at night. She pushed open the door to the inner room, but her steps slowed as she entered. No wonder she had not been able to dream herself here. The room was nothing like what she remembered. That heavily carved table and tall, throne-like chair. The vine-carved stools arranged in a perfect curve in front of the table, not one so much as an inch out of place. Swan Sanche affected simple furnishings, as if pretending she was still only a fisherman's daughter, and she kept only one extra chair, which she did not always let visitors use. And that white vase full of red roses, rigidly arranged on a pedestal like a monument. Swan enjoyed flowers, but she preferred a bouquet of colors, like a field of wildflowers in miniature. Above the fireplace had hung a simple drawing of fishing boats in tall reeds. Now there were two paintings, one of which Nynaeve recognized. Rand, battling the Forsaken who had called himself Baalzamon, in the clouds above Falma. The other, on three wooden panels, portrayed scenes that linked to nothing she could pull out of her memory. The door opened, and Nynaeve's heart leaped into her throat. A red-haired accepted she had never seen before stepped into the room and stared at her. She did not wink out of existence. Just as Nynaeve was preparing to leap back to Shiriam's study, the red-haired woman said, "Nynaeve, if Milane knew you were using her face, she'd do more than put you in a child's dress." And just that suddenly she was Egwene, in her Aiel garb. "You nearly frightened 10 years out of me," Nynaeve muttered. "So the wise ones have finally decided to let you come and go as you please? Or is Milane behind—" "You should be frightened," Egwene snapped, color rising in her cheeks. "You are a fool, Nynaeve. A child playing in the barn with a candle." Nynaeve gaped. "Egwene berating her?" "You listen to me, Egwene Alvear. I'll not take that from Milane, and I won't take it. You had best take it from someone before you get yourself killed. I ought to take that stone ring away from you. I should have given it to Elaine and told her not to let you use it at all." "Told her not? Do you think Milane was exaggerating?" Egwene said sternly, shaking her finger almost exactly like Milane. "She was not, Nynaeve. The wise ones have told you the simple truth about Tel Irunriod time and again, but you seem to think they're fools whistling in a high wind. You are supposed to be a grown woman, not a silly little child. I vow, whatever sense you once had in your head seems to have vanished like a puff of smoke. Well, find it, Nynaeve." She sniffed loudly, rearranging the shawl on her shoulders. "Right now you are trying to play with the pretty flames in the fireplace, too foolish to realize you might fall in." Nynaeve stared in amazement. They argued often enough, but Egwene had never, ever tried to dress her down like a girl caught with her fingers in the honey jar. Never! The dress. It was the accepted's dress she was wearing, and someone else's face. She changed herself back to herself, in a good blue wool that she had often worn for circle meetings and to put the council straight. She felt robed in all her old authority as wisdom. "I am well aware of how much I don't know," she said levelly. "But those Aiel, do you realize you could dream yourself into something you could not get out of? Dreams are real here. If you let yourself drift into a fond dream, it could trap you. You'd trap yourself until you died. Will you? There are nightmares walking Tel Irunriod, Nynaeve." "Will you let me speak?" Nynaeve barked. Or rather, she tried to bark it. There was rather too much frustrated pleading in there to suit her. Any at all would have been too much. "No, I will not," Egwene said firmly. "Not until you want to say something worth listening to. I said nightmares, and I meant nightmares, Nynaeve. When someone has a nightmare while in Tel Irun Riad, it is real, too. And sometimes it survives after the dreamer has gone. You just don't realize, do you?" Suddenly, rough hands enveloped Nynaeve's arms, her head whipped from side to side, eyes bulging. Two huge, ragged men lifted her into the air, faces half-melted ruins of coarse flesh, drooling mouths full of sharp, yellowed teeth. She tried to make them vanish. If a wise one dreamwalker could, so could she. And one of them ripped her dress open down the front like parchment. The other seized her chin in a horny, calloused hand and twisted her face toward him, his head bent toward her, mouth opening. Whether to kiss or bite, she did not know, but she would rather die than allow either. She flailed for Sidar and found nothing. It was horror filling her, not anger. Thick fingernails dug into her cheeks, holding her head steady. Egwene had done this somehow. Egwene! "Please, Egwene!" It was a squeal, and she was too terrified to care. "Please!" The men, creatures, vanished, and her feet thudded to the floor. For a moment all she could do was shudder and weep. Hastily she repaired the damage to her dress, but the scratches from long fingernails remained on her neck and chest. Clothing could be mended easily in Tel Irun Riad, but whatever happened to a human? Her knees shook so badly that it was all she could do to stay upright. She half expected Egwene to comfort her, and for once she would have accepted it gladly. But the other woman only said, "There are worse things here, but nightmares are bad enough. I made these and unmade them, but even I have trouble with those I just find. And I did not try to hold them, Nynaeve. If you knew how to unmake them, you could have." Nynaeve tossed her head angrily, refusing to scrub the tears from her cheeks. "I could have dreamed myself away. To Shiriam's study. Or back to my bed." She did not sound sulky. Of course she did not. "If you had not been too scared, spitless to think of it," Egwene said dryly. "Oh, take that sullen look off your face. It looks silly on you." She glared at the other woman, but it did not work as it usually did. Instead of flaring into argument, Egwene merely arched an eyebrow at her. "None of this looks like Swan Sanche," Nynaeve said to change the subject. What had gotten into the girl? "It doesn't," Egwene agreed, looking around the room. "I see why I had to come by way of my old room in the novices' quarters, but I suppose people do decide to try something new sometimes." "That is what I mean," Nynaeve told her patiently. She had not sounded sulky, and she had not looked sullen. It was ridiculous. "The woman who furnished this room doesn't look at the world the same as the woman who chose what used to be here. Look at those paintings. I don't know what the triple thing is, but you can recognize the other as well as I." They had both seen it happen. "Bonwyn, I should say," Egwene said thoughtfully. "You never did listen to the lectures as you should. It is a triptych. Whatever it is, it's the other that's important." She had listened to the yellows well enough. The rest was a pack of useless nonsense, often as not. "It seems to me that the woman who hung it wants to be reminded how dangerous Rand is. If Swan Sanche has turned against Rand for some reason, Egwene, this could be far worse than just her wanting Elaine back in the tower." "Perhaps," Egwene said judiciously. "Maybe the papers will tell us something. You search in here. When I finish with Lyanna's desk, I will help you." Nynaeve stared indignantly at Egwene's back as she left. "You search in here, indeed. Egwene had no right to give her orders. She ought to march right after her and tell her so in no uncertain terms." "Then why are you standing here like a lump?" she asked herself angrily. Searching the papers was a good idea, and she might as well do so in here as out there. In fact, the Ammerlin's desk was more likely to hold something important. Grumbling to herself about what she would do to set Egwene straight, she stalked to the thickly carved table kicking her skirts with every step. There was nothing on the table except three ornately lacquered boxes, arrayed with painful precision. Remembering the sorts of traps that could be set by someone wanting to ensure privacy, she made a long stick to push open the hinged lid of the first, a golden-green thing decorated with wading herons. It was a writing case, with pens and ink and sand. The largest box, with red roses twining through golden scrolls, held 20 or more delicate carvings of ivory and turquoise, animals and people, all laid out on pale gray velvet. As she pushed up the lid of the third box, golden hawks fighting among white clouds in a blue sky, she noticed that the first two were closed again. Things like that happened here. Everything seemed to want to remain as it was in the waking world, and on top of that, if you took your eyes away for a moment, details could be different when you looked back. The third box did hold documents. The stick vanished, and she gingerly lifted out the top sheet of parchment. Formally signed Jolene Aes Sedai, it was a humble request to serve a set of penances that made Nynaeve wince just scanning them rapidly. Nothing there that mattered except to Jolene. A scrawl at the bottom said, "Approved," in angular script. As she reached to put the parchment down, it faded away. The box was closed, too. Sighing, she opened it again. The papers inside looked different. Holding the lid, she lifted them out one by one and read quickly, or tried to read. Sometimes the letters and reports vanished while she was still picking them up, sometimes when she was no more than halfway down a page. If they had a salutation, it was simply, "Mother, with respect." Some were signed by Aes Sedai, others by women with other titles, nobles, or no honorific at all. None of it seemed to bear on the matter at hand. The Marshal General of Saldaea and his army could not be found, and Queen Tenobia was refusing to cooperate. She managed to finish that report, but it assumed that the reader knew why the man was not in Saldaea and what the Queen was supposed to be cooperating about. No report had come from any Aja's eyes and ears in Tanchico for 3 weeks, but she got no further than that one fact. Some trouble between Ilion on one side and Morandi on the other was abating, and Pedro Nile was claiming credit. Even in the few lines she got, she could see the writer's teeth gnashing. The letters were all no doubt very important, those she was able to hurry through and those that faded away under her eyes, but of no use to her at all. She had just begun what seemed to be a report on a suspected, that was the word used, gathering of blue sisters, when a wretched cry of, "Oh, light, no!" came from the outer room. Darting for the door, she made a stout wooden club appear in her hands, its head bristling with spikes. But when she dashed in, expecting to find Egwene defending herself, the woman was standing behind the keeper's table, staring at nothing. With a look of horror on her face, to be sure, but still unharmed and unthreatened that Nynaeve could see. Egwene gave a start at the sight of her, then gathered herself visibly. "Nynaeve, Elida is Amarlin's seat!" "Don't be a goose," Nynaeve scoffed. "Yet the other room, so unlike Suan Sanche. You're imagining things. You must be." "I had a parchment in my hands, Nynaeve, signed Elida do Avrini Aroihan, Watcher of the Seals, Flame of Tar Valon, the Amarlin's seat, and sealed with the Amarlin's seal." Nynaeve's stomach tried to flutter up into her chest. "But how? What has happened to Swan? Egwene, the tower doesn't depose an Amarlin except for something serious. Only 2 in nearly 3,000 years. Maybe Rand was serious enough." Egwene's voice was steady, though her eyes were still too wide. "Maybe she became ill with something the Yellows couldn't heal, or fell down the stairs and broke her neck. What matters is that Elida is Amarlin. I don't think she will support Rand as Swan did." "Moiraine," Nynaeve muttered, so sure that Swan would put the tower behind him. She could not imagine Suan Sanche dead. She had hated the woman often, been the slightest bit afraid of her on occasion. She could admit that now, to herself anyway, Yet she had respected her, too. She had thought that Swan would last forever. Elida. Light! She's as mean as a snake and as cruel as a cat. There's no telling what she might do. I am afraid I have a clue. Egwene pressed both hands to her stomach, as though to quell flutters of her own. It was a very short document. I managed to read it all. All loyal sisters are required to report the presence of the woman Moiraine Damodred. She is to be detained, if possible, by whatever means are necessary, and returned to the White Tower for trial on charge of treason. The same sort of language that was apparently used about Elaine. If Elida wants Moiraine arrested, it must mean she knows Moiraine has been helping Rand, and she does not like it. Talking was good. Talking kept her from sicking up. Treason. They stilled women for that. She had wanted to bring Moiraine down. Now Elida was going to do it for her. She certainly won't support Rand.
Exactly.
Loyal sisters. Egwene, that fits with the Makura woman's message. Whatever happened to Swan, the Ajahs have split over Elida as Amarlin. It must be.
Yes, of course. Very good, Nynaeve. I did not see that.
Her smile was so pleased that Nynaeve smiled back. There's a report on the Amarlin's writing table about a gathering of blues. I was just reading it when you shouted. I'll wager the blues didn't support Elida. The blue and red Ajahs had a sort of armed truce at the best of times, and came near going for each other's throats at the worst. But when they went back into the inner room, the report was not to be found. There were plenty of documents. Jolene's letter had reappeared. A brief reading made Egwene's eyebrows climb nearly to her hair, but not the one that they wanted.
"Can you remember what it said?" Egwene asked.
"I had just gotten a few lines when you shouted, and I just can't remember."
"Try, Nynaeve. Try very hard."
"I am, Egwene, but it will not come. I am trying." What she was doing hit Nynaeve like a sudden hammer between the eyes. Excusing herself. To Egwene, a girl whose bottom she had switched for throwing a tantrum not more than 2 years ago. And a moment earlier she had been proud as a hen with a new egg because Egwene was pleased with her. She remembered quite clearly the day when the balance between them had shifted, when they ceased being the wisdom and the girl who fetched when the wisdom said fetch, becoming instead just two women far from home. It seemed that balance had shifted further, and she did not like it. She was going to have to do something to move it back where it belonged. The lie. She had deliberately lied to Egwene for the first time ever today. That was why her moral authority had vanished, why she was floundering around, unable to assert herself properly. "I drank the tea, Egwene." She forced each word deliberately. She had to force them. "The Makura woman's fork-root tea. She and Lucy hauled us upstairs like sacks of feathers. That is about how much strength we had between us. If Tom and Julin hadn't come to pull us out by the scruffs of our necks, we would probably be there still, or else on our way to the tower, so full of fork root we wouldn't wake up until we got here." Taking a deep breath, she tried for a tone of righteous firmness, but it was difficult when you had just confessed to having been an utter fool. What came out sounded much more tentative than she liked. "If you tell the wise ones about this, especially that Milane, I'll box your ears." Something in that should have sparked Egwene's ire. It seemed odd to want to start a row. Usually their quarrels were over Egwene refusing to see reason, and they seldom ended pleasantly, since the girl had formed the habit of continuing to refuse. But that was certainly better than this. Yet Egwene only smiled at her. An amused smile. A condescending amused smile. "I more than suspected as much, Nynaeve. You used to drone on about herbs day and night, but you never mentioned any plant called fork root. I was sure you'd never heard of it until that woman mentioned it. You've always tried to put the best face on things. If you fell headfirst into a pigsty, you'd try to convince everybody you did it on purpose. Now what we have to decide—"
"I do no such thing," Nynaeve spluttered.
"You certainly do. Facts are facts. You might as well stop whining about it and help me decide.
Whining. This was not going at all the way she wanted. They are no such thing. Not facts, I mean. I have never done what you said.
For a moment, Egwene stared at her silently. You will not let go of this, will you?
Very well.
You lied to me.
It was not a lie, she muttered.
Not exactly. The other woman ignored her interruption.
And you lie to yourself. Do you remember what you made me drink the last time I lied to you?
Suddenly a cup was in her hand, full of viscous, sickly green liquid. It looked as if it had been scooped from a scummy, stagnant pond.
The only time I ever lied to you. The memory of that taste was an effective discouragement. If you cannot tell the truth even to yourself...
Nynaeve took a step back before she could stop herself. Boiled catfern and powdered mavin's leaf. Her tongue writhed at just the thought.
I did not really lie, actually. Why was she making excuses?
I just didn't tell the whole truth.
I am the wisdom.
I was the wisdom. That ought to count for something still.
You cannot really think, just tell her. You're not the child here, and you certainly are not going to drink.
Egwene pushed the cup nearly under her nose. She could smell the acrid tang.
All right, she said hastily.
This can't be happening. But she could not take her eyes off that brimming cup, and she could not stop the words tumbling out.
Sometimes I try to make things look better for myself than they were. Sometimes. But never anything important. I've never lied about anything important. Never, I swear. Only small things.
The cup vanished, and Nynaeve heaved a sigh of relief.
Fool, fool woman. She couldn't have made you drink it. What is wrong with you?
What we have to decide, Egwene said, as if nothing at all had happened, is who to tell. Moiraine certainly has to know, and Rand, but if everyone hears of it... The Aiel are peculiar, about Aes Sedai no less than anything else. I think they'll follow Rand as he who comes with the dawn in spite of anything, but once they learn the White Tower is against him, maybe they won't be so fervent.
They'll learn sooner or later, Nynaeve muttered. She could not have made me drink it.
Later better than sooner, Nynaeve. So don't you go bursting out in a temper and telling the wise ones about this at our next meeting. In fact, it would be best if you didn't mention this visit to the tower at all. That way, maybe you can keep it secret.
I am not a fool, Nynaeve said stiffly, and felt a slow burn when Egwene quirked that eyebrow at her again.
She was not about to bring the visit up with the wise ones. Not because it was easier defying them behind their backs. Nothing like that. And she was not trying to put a good face on things. It was not fair that Egwene could leap about Telairun Riad however she wanted, while she had to put up with lectures and bullying.
I know you are not, Egwene said, unless you let your temper get the better of you. You need to hold your temper and keep your wits about you if you're right about the Forsaken, especially Mogadine.
Nynaeve glowered at her, opening her mouth to say that she could too keep her temper and she would smack Egwene's ears if she thought differently, but the other woman gave her no chance.
We must find that gathering of Blue Sisters, Nynaeve. If they oppose Elida, maybe, just maybe, they will support Rand the way Swan did. Was a town mentioned, or a village, a country even?
I cannot remember.
She struggled to take the defensive note out of her voice.
Light. I confessed everything, made a fool of myself, and it's only made things worse.
I will keep trying.
Good. We must find them, Nynaeve.
For a moment Egwene studied her while she refused to repeat herself.
Nynaeve, take care concerning Mogadine. Do not go rushing off like a bear in spring just because she got away from you in Tanchico.
I am not a fool, Egwene, Nynaeve said carefully.
It was frustrating having to hold her temper, but if all Egwene would do was ignore it or scold her, there was nothing to be gained beyond looking a bigger ninny head than she did already.
I know. You said that. Just be sure you remember it. Be careful.
Egwene did not fade away this time. She vanished as suddenly as Brigitta. Nynaeve stared at the spot where she had been, running through her head all the things she should have said. Finally, she realized that she could stand there all night. She was repeating herself, and the time for saying anything was past. Grumbling under her breath, she stepped out of Tel Iron Riod, back to her bed in Sienda. Egwene's eyes popped open in near total darkness, broken only by a little moonlight streaming in through the smoke hole. She was glad to be under a pile of blankets. The fire was out, and freezing cold filled the tent. Her breath turned to mist in front of her face. Without raising her head, she scanned the interior. No wise ones. She was still alone. That was her biggest fear on these solitary excursions into Tel Iron Riod, returning to find Amis or one of the others waiting for her. Well, maybe not her biggest fear. The dangers in the world of dreams were every bit as great as she had told Nynaeve, but a big one nonetheless. It was not punishment that frightened her, not the sort that Bear doled out. Had she wakened to find a wise one staring at her, she would have accepted such gladly. But Amis had told her near the beginning that if she entered Tel Iron Riod without one of them accompanying her, they would send her away, refuse to teach her any longer. That made her quail far more than anything else they could do. But even so, she had to push ahead. As rapidly as they taught, they were not rapid enough. She wanted to know now, to know everything. Channeling, she lit her lamp and put flames in the fire pit. Nothing remained for them to burn, but she tied the weave off. She lay there watching her breath mist in front of her mouth and waited for warmth enough to dress. It was late, but perhaps Moiraine would still be awake. What had happened with Nynaeve still amazed her. I think she'd actually have drunk if I had pressed her. She'd been so afraid that Nynaeve would learn that she certainly did not have the Wise One's permission to jaunt about in the world of dreams alone, so sure that the flush of embarrassment had given her away, that all she could think of was keeping Nynaeve from speaking, keeping her from winkling out the truth. And she had been so sure that Nynaeve would find out anyway. The woman was quite capable of turning her in and saying it was for her own good, that all she could do was talk, try to keep the focus on whatever Nynaeve was doing wrong. No matter how angry Nynaeve made her, she could not seem to bring up a shout. And with all of that, somehow, she had gained the upper hand. Come to think of it, Moiraine seldom raised her voice, and when she did, she was least effective in having what she wanted done. It had been so even before she began behaving so strangely with Rand. The wise ones never yelled at anyone either, except each other sometimes, and for all their grumping about the chiefs no longer listening, they still seemed to get their way much more often than not. There was an old saying that she had never really understood before. He strains to hear a whisper who refuses to hear a shout. She would not shout at Rand again. A quiet, firm, womanly voice, that was the thing. For the matter, she ought not to shout at Nynaeve either. She was a woman, not a girl throwing tantrums. She found herself giggling. She especially ought not to raise her voice with Nynaeve when speaking calmly produced such results. The tent finally seemed warm enough, and she scampered out, dressing quickly. She still had to break ice in her water pitcher before she could wash the sleep out of her mouth. Tossing the dark woolen cloak about her shoulders, she untied the strands of fire. Fire by itself was dangerous to leave tied, and as the flames vanished, ducked out of the tent. Cold closed on her like an icy vice as she hurried through the camp. Only the nearest tents were really visible to her, low, shadowed shapes that could have been part of the rugged earth, save that the camp extended for miles into the mountainous land to either side. These tall, jagged peaks were not the spine of the world. That was much higher, and lay days to the west yet. She approached Rand's tent hesitantly. A sliver of light showed along the tent flap. A maiden seemed to rise out of the ground as she came closer, horn bow on her back, quiver at her waist and spears and buckler in hand. Egwene could not make out any others in the darkness, but she knew they were there, even here surrounded by six clans, all claiming loyalty to the Kara Karn. The Miagoma were somewhere to the north, paralleling their march. Timolan would not say what his intentions were. Where the other clans were, Ran did not seem to care. His attention was all on the race for Jangai Pass.
"Is he awake, Inila?" she asked.
Moon shadows shifted on the maiden's face as she nodded.
"He does not sleep enough. A man cannot go without rest."
She sounded for all the world like a mother fretting over her son. A shadow beside the tent stirred, became Avienda with her shawl wrapped around her. She did not seem to feel the cool, only the hour.
"I would sing him a lullaby if I thought it might work. I have heard of women being kept awake all night by an infant, but a grown man should know that others would like to have their blankets."
She and Inila shared a quiet chuckle. Shaking her head over Aiel's strangeness, Egwene bent to peer through the crack. Several lamps lit the interior. He was not alone. Natale's dark eyes looked haggard, and he stifled a yawn. He at least wanted sleep. Rand lay sprawled close by one of the gilded oil lamps, reading a battered leather-bound book. One translation or another of the prophecies of the dragon, if she knew him at all. Abruptly he flipped back through the pages, read, then laughed. She tried to tell herself there was nothing of madness in that laugh, only bitterness. "A fine joke," he told Natale, snapping the book shut and tossing it to him. "Read page 287 and page 400, and tell me if you don't agree."
Egwene's mouth tightened as she straightened. He really should be more careful with the book. She could not speak to him, not in front of the Gleeman. It was a shame that he had to use a man he barely knew for company. No, he had Avienda, and the chiefs often enough, and Lan every day, and Matt sometimes.
"Why don't you join them, Avienda? If you were there, maybe he'd want to talk of something besides that book."
"He wanted to talk with the Gleeman, Egwene, and he seldom does that in front of me or anyone. Had I not left, he and Natale would have."
"Children are a great worry, I have heard," Inila laughed, "and sons the worst. You may find out the truth of this for me, now that you have given up the spear."
Avienda gave her a moonlit frown and stalked back to her place against the side of the tent like an offended cat.
Inila seemed to think that funny, too. She clutched her sides, laughing. Muttering to herself about Aiel humor, she almost never understood it, Egwene made her way to Moiraine's tent, not far from Rand's. Here, too, there was a sliver of light, and she knew that the Aes Sedai was awake. Moiraine was channeling, only tiny amounts of the power, but still enough for Egwene to sense. Lan lay sleeping nearby, wrapped in his warder's cloak. Except for his head and boots, the rest of him seemed part of the night. Gathering her cloak, she held her skirts up and tiptoed so as not to wake him. His breathing did not change, but something made her look at him again. Moonlight glinted on his eyes, open and watching her. Even as she turned her head, they closed again. Not another muscle stirred. He might never have awakened at all. Sometimes the man unnerved her. Whatever Nynaeve saw in him, she could not see. Kneeling beside the tent flap, she peered in. Moiraine sat surrounded by the glow of Saidar, the small blue stone that usually hung on her forehead, dangling from her fingers in front of her face. It shone, adding a bit to the light of a single lamp. The fire pit held only ashes. Even the smell was gone. "May I come in?"
She had to repeat herself before Moiraine answered.
"Of course."
The light of Saidar faded away, and the Aes Sedai began fastening the fine golden chain back into her hair.
"You were eavesdropping on Rand?"
Egwene settled herself beside the other woman. It was as cold in the tent as it was outside. She channeled flames atop the ashes in the fire pit and tied the flow.
"You said you would not do it again."
"I said that since the Wise Ones could watch his dreams, we should allow him some privacy. They have not asked again since he shut them out, and I have not offered. Remember that they have their own goals, which may not be those of the tower." As quickly as that, they had come to it.
Egwene was still not sure how to tell what she knew without betraying herself to the wise ones, but perhaps the only method was to just tell it and then feel her way. Elida is Amarlin, Moiraine. I do not know what has happened to Swan.
How do you know? Moiraine said quietly. Did you learn something dreamwalking? Or has your talent as a dreamer finally manifested itself?
That was her way out. Some of the Aes Sedai in the tower thought that she might be a dreamer, a woman whose dreams foretold the future. She did have dreams that she knew were significant, but learning to interpret them was another matter. The wise ones said the knowledge had to come from within, and none of the Aes Sedai had been any more help. Rand, sitting down in a chair, and somehow she knew that the chair's owner would be murderously angry at having her chair taken. That the owner was a woman was as much as she could pick out of that, and not a thing more. Sometimes the dreams were complex. Perrin lounging with Fael on his lap, kissing her while she played with the short-cut beard that he wore in the dream. Behind them two banners waved, a red wolf's head and a crimson eagle. A man in a bright yellow coat stood near to Perrin's shoulder, a sword strapped to his back. In some way she knew that he was a tinker, though no tinker would even touch a sword. And every bit of it except the beard seemed important. The banners, Fael kissing Perrin, even the tinker. Every time he moved closer to Perrin, it was as if a chill of doom shot through everything. Another dream. Matt throwing dice with blood streaming down his face, the wide brim of his hat pulled low so she could not see his wound, while Tom Marilyn put his hand into a fire to draw out the small blue stone that now dangled on Moiraine's forehead. Or a dream of a storm, great dark clouds rolling without wind or rain, while forked lightning bolts, everyone identical, rent the earth. She had the dreams, but as a dreamer she was a failure so far.
I saw an arrest warrant for you, Moiraine, signed by Elida as Amarlin, and it was no ordinary dream.
All true. Just not all of the truth. She was suddenly glad that Nynaeve was not there. I'd be the one staring at a cup if she was.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills. Perhaps it will not matter so much if Rand takes the Aiel across the Dragon Wall.
I doubt that Elida has continued to approach rulers, even if she knows that Swan was doing so.
Is that all you can say? I think Swan was your friend once, Moiraine. Can't you shed a tear for her?
The Aes Sedai looked at her, and that cool, serene gaze told her how far she had to go before she could use that title herself. Sitting, Egwene was nearly a head taller, and she was stronger in the power besides, but there was more to being Aes Sedai than strength.
I have no time for tears, Egwene. The Dragon Wall is not many days distant now, and the Alguenya... Swan and I were friends once. In a few months it will be 21 years since we began the search for the Dragon Reborn. Only the two of us, newly raised Aes Sedai. Sierin Vayu was raised Amarlin shortly after, a gray with more than a touch of red in her. Had she learned what we intended, we would have spent the rest of our lives doing penance with red sisters watching us even while we slept. There is a saying in Kyrian, though I have heard it as far away as Tarabon and Saldaya. Take what you want, and pay for it. Swan and I took the path we wanted, and we knew we would have to pay for it eventually.
I do not see how you can be so calm. Swan could be dead, or even stilled. Elida will either oppose Rand altogether or try to hold him somewhere until Tarman Gaiden. You know she'll never let a man who can channel run free. At least not everyone is behind Elida. Some of the Blue Aja are gathering somewhere, I don't know where yet, and I think others have left the tower too. Nynaeve said that she was given a message about all sisters being welcome to return to the tower by an Eyes and Ears of the Yellow. If Blues and Yellows have both gone, others must have. And if they oppose Elida, they may support Rand.
Moiraine sighed, a soft sound.
Do you expect me to be happy that the White Tower has split apart? I am Aes Sedai, Egwene. I gave my life to the tower long before I ever suspected the dragon would be reborn in my lifetime. The tower has been a bulwark against the shadow for 3,000 years. It has guided rulers to wise decisions, stopped wars before they began, halted wars that did begin. That humankind even remembers that the Dark One waits to escape, that the last battle will come, is because of the tower. The tower, whole and united. I could almost wish that every sister had sworn to Elida, whatever happened to Swan. And Rand? Egwene kept her voice just as steady, just as smooth. The flames were beginning to put a little warmth into the air, but Moiraine had just added her own chill. The dragon reborn. You yourself said that he cannot be ready for Tarmon Gaiden unless he is allowed his freedom, both to learn and to affect the world. The tower united could take him prisoner despite all the Aiel in the waste. Moiraine smiled a small smile. You learn. Cool reason is always better than hot words. But you forget that only 13 sisters linked can shield any man from Saidin, and even if they do not know the trick of tying flows, fewer can hold that shield. I know you are not giving up, Moiraine. What do you mean to do? I mean to deal with the world as I find the world for as long as I can. At least Rand will be easier to be around, now that I no longer need try to turn him from what he wants. I suppose I should be happy that he does not make me fetch his wine. He does listen most of the time, even if he seldom gives any sign what he thinks of what I tell him. I will leave you to tell him about Swan and the tower. That would avoid awkward questions. With Rand as big-headed as he was, he might want to know more about her dreaming than she could invent. There's something else. Nynaeve has seen Forsaken in Tel Irunriod. She mentioned every last one still alive, except Asmodeon and Mogadine, including Lanfear. She thinks they are plotting something, perhaps together. Lanfear, Moiraine said after a moment. They both knew that Lanfear had visited Rand in Tyr, and maybe other times that he had not told them of. No one had much knowledge of the Forsaken except the Forsaken themselves. Only fragments of fragments remained in the tower. But it was known that Lanfear had loved Luz Theron Telamon. They, too, and Rand, knew that she still did. With luck, the Aes Sedai went on, we will not have to worry about Lanfear. The others Nynaeve saw are another matter. You and I must keep as close a watch as we can. I wish more of the wise ones could channel. She gave a small laugh. But I might as well wish they were all tower-trained while I am about it, or to live forever. They may be strong in many ways, but they are sadly lacking in others. A watch is all very well, but what else? If 6 Forsaken come at him together, he will need every bit of help we can give him. Moiraine leaned over to put a hand on her arm, a look of affection on her face. We cannot hold his hand forever, Egwene. He has learned to walk. He is learning to run. We can only hope he learns before his enemies catch him, and of course continue to advise him, to guide him when we can. Straightening, she stretched and stifled a small yawn behind her hand. It is late, Egwene, and I expect that Rand will have us breaking camp in a very few hours now, even if he gets no sleep at all. I, however, would like to take what rest I can before facing my saddle. Egwene made ready to go, but first she had a question. Moiraine, why have you started doing everything Rand tells you to? Even Nynaeve doesn't think it is right. She does not, does she? Moiraine murmured. She will be Aes Sedai yet, whatever she wishes. Why? Because I remembered how to control Saidar. After a moment, Egwene nodded. To control Saidar, first you had to surrender to it. It was not until she was shivering her way back to her own tent that she realized Moiraine had spoken to her the whole time as an equal. Perhaps she was closer to being ready to choose her Aja than she thought.
Chapter 16. An Unexpected Offer. Sunlight creeping through the window awoke Nynaeve. For a moment she lay sprawled atop the striped coverlet. Elaine lay sleeping in the other bed. The early morning was already warm, and the night had not been much better, but that was not the reason Nynaeve's shift was twisted and sweaty. Her dreams after discussing what she had seen with Elaine had not been good. In most, she had been back in the tower being dragged before the Amyrlin, who was sometimes Elida and sometimes Mogadine. In some, Rand had been lying beside the Amyrlin's writing table like a dog, collared and leashed and muzzled. The dreams about Egwene had been as bad in a way. Boiled catfern and powdered maven's leaf tasted just as bad in a dream as they did awake. Making her way to the washstand, she cleansed her face and scrubbed her teeth with salt and soda. The water was not hot, but it could not be called cool either. The sodden shift she stripped off and dug a fresh one from one of the chests, along with a hairbrush and mirror. Peering at her own image, she regretted undoing her braid for comfort. It had not helped, and now her hair hung in a tangle to her waist. Sitting down on the chest, she laboriously worked the knots out, then began giving her hair its 100 strokes. 3 scratches ran down her neck and disappeared beneath her shift. They were not as red as they might have been, thanks to an ointment of heal-all taken from the Makura woman. She had told Elaine they came from brambles. Foolish. She suspected that Elaine knew it was not true, despite her tale of looking about the tower grounds after Egwene left. But she had been too upset to think straight. She had snapped at the other woman several times, for no reason except that she was thinking about her unfair treatment by Milane and Egwene. Not that it doesn't do her good to be reminded she's not the daughter heir here. Still, it was none of the girl's fault. She would have to make it up to her. In the mirror, she saw Elaine rise and begin washing. "I still think my plan is best," the girl said, scrubbing her face. Her raven-dyed hair did not seem to have one snarl, despite her curls. "We could be in Tyr much more quickly my way." Her plan was to abandon the coach once they reached the Eldar, at some small village, where there would not likely be many white cloaks, and, just as important, no eyes and ears for the tower. There they were to take a riverboat down to Ibudar, where they could find a ship for Tyr. That they had to go to Tyr was no longer in doubt. Tar Valon they would avoid at all cost. "How long before a boat stops where we are?" Nynaeve said patiently. She had thought this was all settled before they went to sleep. It had been, to her mind. "You yourself said that every boat might not stop. And how long do we wait in Ibudar before we find a ship for Tyr?" Putting the brush down, she began remaking her braid. "The villagers hang out a flag if they want a boat to put in, and most will. And there are always ships for anywhere in a seaport the size of Ibudar." As if the girl had ever been in a seaport of any size before leaving the tower with Nynaeve. Elaine always thought that whatever she had not learned of the world as daughter heir of Andor, she had learned in the tower, even after plenty of proof to the contrary. And how dare she put on that forbearing tone with her? "We are not likely to find that gathering of blues on a ship, Elaine." Her own plan was to stick with the coach, cross the rest of Amadicia, then Altara and Mirandi to Far Madding in the hills of Kintara and over the plains of Maredo to Tyr. It would certainly take longer, but aside from the chance of finding that gathering somehow, coaches very rarely sank. She could swim, but she was not comfortable with land completely out of sight. Patting her face dry, Elaine changed her shift and came to help with doing the braid. Nynaeve was not fooled. She would hear about boats again. Her stomach did not like boats. Not that that had influenced her decision, of course. If she could bring Aes Sedai to Rand's aid, it would be well worth the longer travel time. "Have you recalled the name?" Elaine asked, weaving the strands of hair. "At least I remembered there was a name. Light, give me time." She was sure there had been a name. A town it would have to be, or a city. She could not have seen the name of a country and forgotten it.
Drawing a long breath, she took a hold on her temper and went on in a milder tone. "I will remember it, Elaine. Just give me time." Elaine made a non-committal sound and continued braiding. After a bit, she said, "Was it really wise to send Birgitta looking for Mogadine?" Nynaeve shot the young woman a sidelong frown, but it rolled off her like water off oiled silk. As a change of subject, this was not the one she would have chosen. "Better we find her than she finds us."
"I suppose so. But what will we do when we find her?"
She had no answer for that. But it was better to be the hunter than the hunted, however roughly it went. The Black Aja had taught her that. The common room was not crowded when they went down, yet even at that early hour there was a sprinkling of pale cloaks among the patrons, mostly on older men, all with officer's rank. No doubt they preferred to eat from the inn's kitchens rather than what white cloak cooks dished up in the garrison. Nynaeve would almost rather have eaten on a tray again, but that little room was like a box. All of these men were intent on their food, the white cloaks no less than the others. Surely it was quite safe. Cooking smells filled the air. Apparently these men wanted beef or mutton even first thing in the morning. No sooner did Elaine's foot leave the last step than Mistress Jaren bustled up to offer them, or the Lady Morellin, rather, a private dining room. Nynaeve never shifted her eyes toward Elaine, but the other woman said, "I think we will eat here. I seldom have the opportunity to eat in a common room, and I quite enjoy it, really. Have one of your girls bring us something cooling. If the day is like this already, I fear I'll swelter before we reach the next stop." It was a constant wonder to Nynaeve that that haughty manner never got them thrown bodily into the street. She'd met enough lords and ladies by now to know that nearly all behaved in that fashion, but still, she would not have put up with it for a minute. The innkeeper, though, bobbed a curtsy, smiling and dry-washing her hands, then showed them to a table near a window looking onto the street, and scurried away to do Elaine's bidding. Perhaps that was her way of getting back at the girl. They were off by themselves, well away from the men already at other tables, but anyone walking by could stare in at them, and if any of their food was hot, which she hoped it was not, they were as far from the kitchens as it was possible to be. When it came, breakfast consisted of spicy muffins, wrapped in a white cloth and still warm, and pleasant even so, yellow pears, blue grapes that looked a bit wizened, and some sort of red things that the serving girl called strawberries, though they looked like no berry that Nynaeve had ever seen. They certainly did not taste anything like straw, especially with clotted cream spooned on top. Elaine claimed to have heard of them, but then she would. With a lightly spiced wine supposedly cooled in the spring house, one sip told her that the spring was not very cool, if there was one. It made a refreshing morning meal. The nearest man was three tables away, and he wore a dark blue woolen coat, a prosperous tradesman, perhaps, but they did not talk. Plenty of time for that when they were on the road again, and could be sure that there was no danger of sharp ears. Nynaeve finished her food well before Elaine. The way the girl took her time quartering a pear, you would think they had all day to sit at table. "I thought it was you, Elaine, but the hare put me off at first." Nynaeve stared at Galad, Elaine's half-brother. Stared was the word, of course. Tall and steely slender, dark of hair and eye, he was the most handsome man she had ever seen. Handsome was not enough. He was gorgeous. She had seen women cluster around him in the tower, even Aes Sedai, all of them smiling like fools. She wiped the smile from her own face. But she could do nothing about her racing heart, nor make herself breathe properly. She did not feel anything for him. It was just that he was beautiful. "Take hold of yourself, woman." "What are you doing here?" She was pleased that she did not sound strangled. It was not fair for a man to look like that. "And what are you doing wearing that?" Elaine's voice was low, but it still held a snap. Nynaeve blinked and realized he wore a shirt of shining mail and a white cloak with two golden knots of rank beneath the flaring sun. She felt color rising in her cheeks, staring at a man's face so hard that she had not even seen what he was wearing. She wanted to hide her own face from humiliation. He smiled, and Nynaeve had to take a deep breath. "I am here because I was one of the children recalled from the north, and I am a child of the light because it seemed the right thing to do. Elaine, when you two and Egwene vanished, it did not take long for Gawain and me to find out that you were not doing penance on a farm, whatever we were told. They had no right to involve you in their plots, Elaine. Any of you."
"You seem to have attained rank very quickly," Nynaeve said. Did the fool man not realize that talking of Aes Sedai plots here was a good way to get them both killed?
"Aemon Valda seemed to think my experience warranted it, wherever gained." His shrug dismissed rank as unimportant. It was not modesty, precisely, but not pretense, either. The finest swordsman among those who came to study with the warders in the tower, he had also stood high in the classes on strategy and tactics, but Nynaeve could not remember him boasting about his prowess, even in jest. Accomplishments meant nothing to him, perhaps because they came so easily.
"Does Mother know of this?" Elaine demanded, still in that quiet voice. Her scowl would have frightened a wild boar, though.
Galad shifted just a hair, uneasily. "There's been no good time to write her. But do not be so sure she will disapprove, Elaine. She is not so friendly with the North as she was. I hear a ban may be made law."
"I sent her a letter, explaining."
Elaine's glare had transformed to puzzlement. "She must understand. She trained in the tower, too."
"Keep your voice down," he said, low and hard. "Remember where you are."
Elaine flushed a deep red, but whether in anger or embarrassment, Nynaeve could not say. Abruptly she realized that he had been speaking as quietly as they, and carefully, too. He had not mentioned the tower once, or Aes Sedai. "Is Egwene with you?" he went on.
"No,"
she replied, and he sighed deeply.
"I had hoped."
Gawain was nearly unhinged with worry when she disappeared. "He cares for her, too. Will you tell me where she is?" Nynaeve took note of that, too. The man had become a white cloak, yet he cared for a woman who wanted to be Aes Sedai. Men were so strange, they were hardly human sometimes.
"We will not,"
Elaine said firmly, the crimson receding from her cheeks.
"Is Gawain here, too? I will not believe he has become a—"
She had the wit to lower her voice further, but she still said,
"A white cloak."
"He remains in the north, Elaine." Nynaeve supposed that he meant Tar Valon, but surely Gawain had gone from there. Surely he could not support Elaida.
"You cannot know what has happened there, Elaine," he continued. "All the corruption and vileness in that place bubbled to the top as it had to. The woman who sent you away has been deposed."
He looked around and dropped his voice to a momentary whisper, despite no one being close enough to overhear.
"Stilled and executed."
Taking a deep breath, he made a disgusted sound.
"It was never a place for you, or for Egwene. I have not been long with the children, but I am certain my captain will give me leave to escort my sister home. That is where you should be, with Mother. Tell me where Egwene is, and I will see that she is brought to Camelin too. You will both be safe there."
Nynaeve's face felt numb.
Stilled and executed.
Not an accidental death or illness. That she had considered the possibility did not make the fact less shocking. Rand had to be the reason. If there had ever been any small hope that the tower might not oppose him, it was gone. Elaine showed no expression at all, her eyes staring at the distance.
"I see my news shocks you," he said in a low voice. "I do not know how deeply that woman meshed you in her plot, but you are free of her now. Let me see you safely to Camelin. No one need know you had any more contact with her than the other girls who went there to learn. Either of you."
Nynaeve showed him her teeth, in what she hoped looked like a smile. It was nice to be included, finally. She could have smacked him. If only he were not so good-looking. "I will think on it," Elaine said slowly. "What you say makes sense, but you must give me time to think. I must think." Nynaeve stared at her. It made sense. The girl was blathering.
"I can give you a little time," he said, "but I do not have much if I am to ask leave. We may be ordered..."
Suddenly there was a square-faced, black-haired white cloak, clapping Galad on the shoulder and grinning widely. Older, he wore the same two knots of rank on his cloak.
"Well, young Galad, you can't keep all the pretty women for yourself. Every girl in town sighs when you walk by, and most of their mothers as well. Introduce me."
Galad scraped back his bench to stand. "I thought I knew them when they came downstairs, Trom. But whatever charm you think I possess, it does not work on this lady. She does not like me, and I think she will not like any friend of mine. If you practice the sword with me this afternoon, perhaps you can attract one or two."
"Never with you around," Trom grumped good-naturedly. "And I'd sooner let the farrier pound my head with his hammer than practice against you."
But he let Galad start him for the door, with only a regretful look at the two women. As they left, Galad shot a glance back at the table, full of frustration and indecision. No sooner were they out of sight than Elaine stood. "Nana, I need you upstairs." Mistress Jaren materialized at her side, inquiring if she had enjoyed her repast, and Elaine said, "I require my driver and footman immediately. Nana will settle the bill." She was moving for the stairs before she finished speaking. Nynaeve stared after her, then dug out her purse and paid the woman, making assurances that everything had been to her mistress's liking, and trying not to wince at the price. Once rid of the woman, she hurried upstairs. Elaine was stuffing their things into the chests any which way, including the sweaty shifts they had hung on the ends of the beds to dry.
"Elaine, what's the matter?"
"We must leave immediately, Nynaeve. At once." She did not look up until the last article was crammed in. "Right this minute, wherever he is, Galad is puzzling over something he may never have faced before. Two things that are right, but opposite. To his mind, it is right to tie me to a pack-horse if necessary and haul me to Mother, to salve her worries and save me from becoming Aes Sedai whatever I want. And it is also right to turn us in, to the White Cloaks or the army or both. That is the law in Amadicia, and White Cloak law, too. Aes Sedai are outlawed here, and so is any woman who has ever trained in the Tower. Mother met Aelron once to sign a trade treaty, and they had to do it in Altara, because Mother could not legally enter Amadicia. I embraced Saidar the moment I saw him, and I won't let it go until we are far from him."
"Surely you exaggerate, Elaine. He is your brother."
"He is not my brother!" Elaine drew a deep breath and let it out slowly. "We had the same father," she said in a calmer voice, "but he is not my brother. I will not have him. Nynaeve, I've told you time and again, but you will not take it in. Galad does what is right. Always. He never lies. Did you hear what he said to that Trom fellow? He didn't say he did not know who we are. Every word he said was the truth. He does what is right, no matter who is hurt by it, even himself or me. He used to tell on Gawain and me for everything, and on himself, too. If he decides the wrong way, we will have White Cloaks lying in ambush for us before we reach the edge of the village." A tap sounded at the door, and Nynaeve's breath caught in her throat. Surely Galad would not really... Elaine's face was set, ready to fight. Hesitantly, Nynaeve cracked the door. It was Tom, and Julin with that fool hat in his hand. "My lady wants us?" Tom asked, with a touch of servility for anyone who might overhear. Able to breathe again, not caring who was listening, she snatched the door the rest of the way open. "Get in here, you two!" She was growing tired of them looking at one another every time she spoke. Before she had the door shut again, Elaine said, "Tom, we must leave right away." The determined look had left her face, and anxiety filled her voice. "Galad is here. You must remember what a monster he was as a child. Well, he is no better grown, and he is a White Cloak besides. He could..." The words seemed to catch in her throat. She stared at Tom, mouth working soundlessly, but no more wide-eyed than he stared at her.
He sat down heavily on one of the chests, never taking his eyes from Elaine's. Clearing his throat roughly, he went on.
I thought I saw him watching the inn. A white cloak. But he looked the man the boy would grow into. I suppose it shouldn't be a surprise he grew into a white cloak at that.
Nynaeve went to the window. Elaine and Tom hardly seemed to notice her passage between them. Traffic was beginning to pick up in the street, farmers and farm carts and villagers mingling with white cloaks and soldiers. Across the way, one white cloak was sitting on an upended barrel, that perfect face unmistakable. Elaine swallowed. Did he recognize you?
No. 15 years changes a man more than it does a boy. Elaine, I thought you had forgotten.
I remembered in Tanchico, Tom.
With a wavering smile, Elaine reached out and tugged one of his long mustaches. Tom smiled back almost as unsteadily. He looked as if he was contemplating a leap from the window. Julin was scratching his head, and Nynaeve wished she had some idea what they were talking about, too, but there were more important matters at hand. We still have to leave before he brings the entire garrison down on us. With him watching, it won't be easy. I haven't seen another patron who looks like they have a coach.
Ours is the only one in the stable yard, Julin said.
Tom and Elaine were still staring at one another, plainly not hearing a word. Driving off with the curtains down was no protection then. Nynaeve was willing to bet that Galad had already learned exactly how they had come to Sienda.
Is there a back way from the stable yard?
A gate wide enough for one of us at a time, Julin said dryly. And what's on the other side is little more than an alley anyway. There aren't more than 2 or 3 streets in this village wide enough for the coach.
He studied that cylindrical hat, turning it in his hands.
I could get close enough to crack his head. If you were ready, you could drive off during the confusion. I could catch you up on the road.
Nynaeve sniffed loudly. How? Gallop after on Skulker? Even if you didn't fall out of the saddle inside a mile, do you think that you would even reach a horse if you attacked a white cloak in that street? Galad was still there across the street, and Trom had joined him, the pair apparently chatting idly. She leaned over and yanked Tom's nearest mustache. Do you have anything to add? Any brilliant plans? Did all your listening to gossip yield anything that might help?
He clapped a hand to his face and gave her an offended look. Not unless you think there's help in Aelron laying claim to some border villages in Altara. A strip the whole length of the border, from Salidar to So Ebon to Mosra. Is there any help in that, Nynaeve? Is there? Try to pull a man's mustache out of his face. Somebody ought to box your ears for once.
What would Aelron want with a strip along the border, Tom? Elaine asked. Perhaps she was interested. She seemed interested in every fool twist and turn of politics and diplomacy. Or perhaps she was just trying to stop an argument. She used to try smoothing over things all the time before she became wrapped up in flirting with Tom.
It isn't the king, child.
His voice softened for her.
It's Pedro Nile. Aelron does what he is told, usually, though he and Nile make out that it isn't so. Most of those villages have been empty since the White Cloak War, what the children call the Troubles. Nile was the general in the field then, and I doubt he's ever given up wanting Altara. If he controls both banks of the Eldar, he can squeeze the river trade to Ebudar, and if he can crack Ebudar, the rest of Altara will trickle into his hands like grain flowing from a hole in a sack.
That is all very well, Nynaeve said firmly before he or the girl could speak again. There had been something in what he had said that tickled her memory, but she could not say what or why. In any case, they had no time for lectures on relations between Amadicia and Altara, not with Galad and Trom watching the front of the inn. She said as much, adding, "What about you, Julin? You consort with low types?" The thief-catcher always sought out the cut-purses and burglars and footpads in a town. He claimed they knew more of what was really going on than any official.
Are there smugglers we can bribe to sneak us out, or... You know the sort of thing we need, man.
I heard little. Thieves keep low in Amadicia, Nynaeve. First offense is branding. Second is loss of your right hand. And third is hanging, whether it's the king's crown or a loaf of bread. There aren't many thieves in a town this size. Not who do it for a living. He was contemptuous of amateur thieves. And for the most part, they only wanted to talk about two things. Whether the prophet is really coming to Amadicia the way rumor says he is, and whether the town fathers might relent and let that traveling menagerie put on a show. Sienda is too far from the borders for smugglers to... She cut him off with peremptory satisfaction. That is it. The menagerie. They all looked at her as if she'd gone mad.
Of course, Tom said, much too mildly. We can get Luca to bring the boar horses back, and make off while they destroy some more of the town. I don't know what you gave him, Nynaeve, but he threw a rock at us as we were driving off.
For once Nynaeve forgave him his sarcasm, feeble as it was, and his lack of wit to see what she saw. That's as may be, Tom Marilyn, but Master Luca wants a patron, and Elaine and I are going to be his patrons. We still have to abandon the coach and team. That smarted. She could have built a snug house in the Two Rivers for what they had cost, and sneak out that back way. Tossing open the chest with the leaf-shaped hinges, she rooted through clothes and blankets and pots and everything that she had not wanted to leave behind with the wagon full of dyes. She had made sure that the men packed everything except the harness, until she came to the gilded caskets and the purses. "Tom, you and Julian go out by that back gate, and find a wagon and team of some sort. Buy some supplies and meet us on the road back to Luca's camp." Regretfully, she filled Tom's hand with gold, not even bothering to count. There was no telling what things would cost, and she did not want him wasting time bargaining.
"That is a wonderful idea," Elaine said, grinning. "Galad will be looking for two women, not a troop of animals and jugglers, and he will never think we would head for Gildan."
Nynaeve had not thought of that. She had intended making Luca head straight for Tyr. A menagerie such as he had put together with tumblers and jugglers in addition to animals could earn its way almost anywhere, she was sure. But if Galad did come looking for them, or send someone, it would be to the east, and he might be smart enough to look even in a menagerie. Men did show brains sometimes, usually when you least expected it.
"That was the first thing I thought of, Elaine."
She ignored the sudden faint taste in her mouth, the acrid memory of boiled cat fern and powdered maven's leaf. Tom and Julian protested, of course. Not the idea as such, but they seemed to think that one of them remaining behind could protect her and Elaine against Galad and any number of white cloaks. They did not seem to realize that if it came to that, channeling would do more than the pair of them and 10 more besides. They still seemed troubled, but she managed to push them both out with the stern injunction, "And don't you dare come back here. We will meet you on the road."
"If it comes to channeling," Elaine quietly said once the door was shut, "we will quickly find ourselves facing the whole White Cloak garrison, and probably the army garrison as well. The power doesn't make us invincible. All it will take is 2 arrows."
"We will worry about that when it comes," Nynaeve told her. She hoped the men had not thought of that. If they had, likely one of them would lurk about and probably rouse Galad's suspicions if he was not careful. She was ready to accept their help when it was needed. Rhonda Macura had taught her that, though having to be rescued like a kitten down a well still galled. But it would be when she thought it necessary, not they. A quick trip downstairs found Mistress Jaren. Her lady had changed her mind. She did not think she could face the heat and dust of travel again so quickly. She intended to nap, and did not want to be disturbed until a late supper that she would send down for. Here was the coin for another night's lodging. The innkeeper was very understanding of a noble lady's delicacy, and how inconstant their desires. Nynaeve thought Mistress Jaren would be understanding of anything short of murder, so long as the reckoning was paid. Leaving the plump woman, Nynaeve cornered one of the serving girls for a moment. A few silver pennies changed hands, and the girl darted off in her apron to find two of the deep bonnets that Nynaeve said looked so shady and cool. Not the sort of thing her lady would wear, of course, but they would do nicely for her. When she got back to the room, Elaine had the gilded caskets on a blanket with the dark polished box holding the recovered Turangrial and the wash-leather purse that held the seal. The fat purses of coin lay beside Nynaeve's scrip on the other bed. Folding the blanket, Elaine tied the bundle with some stout cord from one of their chests. Nynaeve had saved everything. She regretted leaving it all behind now. It was not just the expense, not only that. You never knew when something was going to come in handy. Take the two woolen dresses that Elaine had laid out on her bed. They were not fine enough for a lady, and too fine for a lady's maid, but if they had left them in Mardisen as Elaine had wanted, they would be in a fine fix for clothing now. Kneeling, Nynaeve rummaged in another chest. A few shifts, two more wool dresses for changes. The pair of cast-iron frying pans and a canvas bag were perfectly good, but too heavy, and the men would certainly not forget replacements for those. The sewing kit in its neat bone-inlaid box, they would never think to buy so much as a pin. Her mind was only partly on her selections, though. "You knew Tom before?" she asked in what she hoped was a casual tone. She watched Elaine from the corner of her eye while pretending to concentrate on rolling stockings. The girl had begun pulling out clothes of her own, sighing over the silks before putting them aside. She froze with her hands deep in one of the chests, and she did not look at Nynaeve. "He was court-barred in Camelin when I was little," she said quietly. "I see." She did not see at all. How did a man go from a court-barred entertaining royalty, the next thing to a noble, to a gleeman wandering from village to village? "He was mother's lover after father died." Elaine had gone back to choosing, and she said it so matter-of-factly that Nynaeve gaped. "Your mother's?" The other woman still was not looking at her, though. "I did not remember him until Tanchico. I was very small. It was his mustaches, and standing close enough to look up at his face, and hearing him recite part of the Great Hunt of the Horn. He thought I'd forgotten again." Her face colored slightly. "I drank too much wine, and the next day I made out that I could not remember anything." Nynaeve could only shake her head. She remembered the night the girl had filled her fool self with wine. At least she had never done that again. Her head the next morning had seemed an effective cure. Now she knew why the girl behaved as she did with Tom. She had seen the same back in the Two Rivers a few times. A girl just old enough to really think of herself as a woman. Who else would she measure herself against except her mother? And sometimes, who better to compete against to prove that she was a woman? Usually it led to no more than trying to be better at everything from cooking to sewing, or maybe some harmless flirting with her father. But in the case of one widow, Nynaeve had seen the woman's nearly grown daughter make a complete fool of herself, trying to capture the man her mother intended to marry. The trouble was, Nynaeve had no idea what to do about this silliness in Elaine. Despite severe lectures and more from her and the women's circle, Sari Ayelin had not settled down until her mother was married again, and she herself had found a husband, too. "I suppose he must have been like a second father to you," Nynaeve said carefully. She pretended to concentrate on her own packing. Tom had certainly been looking at the girl that way. It explained so much. "I hardly think of him so." Elaine appeared intent on deciding how many silk shifts to take, but her eyes saddened. "I cannot really remember my father. I was only a baby when he died. Gawain says he spent all of his time with Galad. Lini tried to make the best of it, but I know he never came to see Gawain or me in the nursery. He would have, I know, once we were old enough to teach things, like Galad, but he died." Nynaeve tried again. "At least Tom is fit for a man of his age. We'd be in a fine fix if he suffered from stiff joints. Old men often do." "He could still do backflips if not for his limp. And I don't care if he does limp. He is intelligent and knowledgeable about the world. He is gentle, and yet I feel quite safe with him. I don't think I should tell him that.
He tries to protect me enough as it is. With a sigh, Nynaeve gave up, for now at least. Tom might look on Elaine as a daughter, but if the girl kept this up, he just might remember that she was not, and then Elaine would find herself in the pickling kettle. Tom is very fond of you, Elaine. Time to shift to some other subject. Are you sure about Galad? Elaine? Are you sure Galad could turn us in, Elaine? The other woman gave a start, wiping a small frown from her face. What? Galad? I'm certain, Nynaeve. And if we refuse to let him take us to Camelin, that will only make the decision for him. Muttering to herself, Nynaeve pulled a silk riding dress out of her chest. Sometimes she thought the Creator had only made men to cause trouble for women. Chapter 17. Heading West. When the serving girl came with the bonnets, Elaine was stretched out on one of the beds in a white silk shift, a damp cloth over her eyes, and Nynaeve was pretending to mend the hem of the pale green dress that Elaine had been wearing. As often as not, she stuck her thumb. She would never have admitted it to anyone, but she was not very good at needlework. She wore her dress, of course. Maids did not loll about like ladies, but she did have her hair hanging loose. Clearly she had no intention of leaving the room any time soon. She thanked the girl in a whisper so as not to wake her lady, and pressed another silver penny on her, with the repeated injunction that her lady was not to be disturbed on any account. As soon as the door clicked shut, Elaine bounded to her feet and began pulling their bundles out from under the beds. Nynaeve tossed the silk gown down and twisted her arms behind her to undo her buttons. In no time at all they were ready, Nynaeve in green wool, Elaine in blue, with the bundles on their backs. Nynaeve carried the scrip with her herbs and the money, Elaine the blanket-wrapped boxes. The deep curving brims of the bonnets hid their faces so well that Nynaeve thought they could have walked right by Galad without him knowing them, especially with her hair down. He would remember the braid. Mistress Jaren, however, might well stop two strange women coming with fat bundles from upstairs. The back stairs ran down the outside of the inn, narrow stone flights clinging to the wall. Nynaeve felt a moment of sympathy for Tom and Julin hauling the heavy chests up these, but mainly her attention was on the stable yard and the slate-roofed stone stable. A yellow dog lay in the shade beneath the coach, sheltering from the already increasing heat, but all of the grooms were inside. Now and again she could see movement beyond the open stable doors, but no one came out. It was shady in there, too. They trotted quickly across the stable yard to the alley between the stable and a tall stone fence. A full dung cart, swarming with flies and scarcely narrower than the alleyway, was just rumbling by. Nynaeve suspected that the glow of Saidar surrounded Elaine, though she could not see it. She herself was hoping that the dog did not decide to bark, that no one came out of the kitchens or the stable. Using the power was no way to sneak off quietly, and talking their way clear would leave traces for Galad to follow. The rough wooden gate at the end of the alley had only a lift latch, and the narrow street beyond, lined with simple stone houses with more thatched roofs than otherwise, was empty, except for a handful of boys, playing some game that seemed to involve hitting each other with a bean bag. The only adult in sight was a man feeding a coat of pigeons on a roof opposite, his head and shoulders up through a trapdoor. Neither he nor the boys more than glanced at them as they shut the gate and started along the winding street as if they had every right to be there. They had walked a good 5 miles west of Sienda along the dusty road before Tom and Julin caught up, Tom driving what looked like a tinker's wagon, save that it was all one color, a drab green, with the paint flaked off in large patches. Nynaeve was grateful to stuff her bundles under the driver's seat and climb up beside him, but not so pleased to see Julin riding Skulker. "I told you not to go back to the inn," she told him, vowing to hit him with something if he looked at Tom. "I did not go back," he said, unaware that he had saved himself a sore head. "I told the head stableman that my lady wanted berries fresh from the country, and Tom and I had to go fetch them. It's the sort of nonsense that some no—" He cut off, clearing his throat,
as Elaine gave him a cool, expressionless look from the other side of Tom. Sometimes he forgot that she really was of royalty.
"We had to have some reason to leave the inn and the stables," Tom said, whipping up the horses. "I suppose you two said you were taken to your room with fainting spells, or the Lady Morellin was, but the grooms would have been wondering why we wanted to wander about in the heat, instead of staying in a nice cool hayloft, with no work to do, and maybe a pitcher of ale. Perhaps we'll not be worth talking about now."
Elaine gave Tom a level look, no doubt for the fainting spells, that he pretended not to see, or perhaps did not. Men could be blind when it suited them. Nynaeve sniffed loudly. He could not miss that. He certainly cracked his whip over the lead horses sharply enough right after. It was all just an excuse so they could take turns riding. That was another thing men did, made excuses to do exactly what they wanted. At least Elaine was frowning at him slightly instead of simpering.
"There is something else I learned last night," Tom went on after a time. "Pedro Nile is trying to unite the nations against Rand."
"Not that I don't believe it, Tom," Nynaeve said. "But how could you learn that? I cannot think some white cloak simply told you."
"Too many people were saying the same thing, Nynaeve. There's a false dragon in Tyr. A false dragon, and never mind prophecies about the Stone of Tyr falling or Kalendor. This fellow is dangerous, and the nations ought to unite, the way they did in the Aiel War. And who better to lead them against this false dragon than Pedro Nile? When so many tongues say the same thing, the same thought exists higher up. And in Amadicia, not even Aelron expresses a thought without asking Nile first."
The old Gleeman always seemed to put together rumors and whispers and come up with right answers far more often than not. No, not a Gleeman. She had to remember that. Whatever he might claim, he had been a court bard, and had probably seen court intrigue like that in his stories at close hand, perhaps even dabbled in it himself, if he had been Morgaze's lover. She eyed him sideways, that leathery face with bushy white eyebrows, those long mustaches as snowy as the hair on his head. There was no accounting for some women's taste.
"It isn't as if we should not have expected something like this." She never had, but she should have.
"Mother will support Rand," Elaine said. "I know she will. She knows the prophecies, and she has as much influence as Pedro Nile."
The slight shake of Tom's head denied the last, at least. Morgaze ruled a wealthy nation, but there were white cloaks in every land and from every land. Nynaeve realized she was going to have to start paying more attention to Tom. Perhaps he really did know as much as he pretended.
"So now you think we should have let Galad escort us to Camelin?"
Elaine leaned forward to give her a firm look past Tom.
"Certainly not. For one thing, there is no way to be sure that that would be his decision. And for another..."
She straightened, obscuring herself behind the man. She seemed to be talking to herself, reminding herself.
"For another, if Mother really has turned against the tower, I want to do all my speaking to her by letter for the time being. She is quite capable of holding us both in the palace for our own good. She may not be able to channel, but I do not want to try going against her until I am full Aes Sedai, if then."
"A strong woman," Tom said pleasantly. "Morgaze would teach you manners quickly enough, Nynaeve."
She gave him another loud sniff. All that loose hair hanging over her shoulders was no good for gripping, but the old fool only grinned at her. The sun stood high by the time they reached the menagerie, still camped exactly where they had left it, in the clearing by the road. In the still heat, even the oaks looked a bit wilted. Except for the horses and the great gray boar horses, the animals were all back in their cages, and the humans were out of sight, too, no doubt inside the wagons that looked not much different from theirs. Nynaeve and the others had all climbed down before Vala and Luca appeared, still in that ridiculous red silk cape. There were no flowery speeches this time, no cape-swirling bows. His eyes widened when he recognized Tom and Julin, narrowed at the box-like wagon behind them. He bent to peer into the deep bonnets, and his smile was not pleasant.
"So, come down in the world, have we, my Lady Morellin?
Or maybe we were never up at all. Stole a coach and some clothes, did you? Well, I would hate to see such a pretty forehead branded. That is what they do here, in case you don't know, if they do not do worse. So, since it seems you've been found out, else why are you running? I would suggest you hurry on as fast as you can. If you want your bloody penny back, it's somewhere up the road. I threw it after you, and it can lie there till Tarman Gaiden for all I care.
You wanted a patron, Nynaeve said, as he was turning away. We can be your patrons.
You? He sneered, but he stopped. Even if a few coins stolen from some lord's purse would help, I will not accept stolen.
We will pay your expenses, Master Luca, Elaine broke in, with that coolly arrogant tone of hers. And 100 gold marks besides, if we can travel with you to Gildan, and if you agree not to stop until you reach the border.
Luca stared at her, running his tongue over his teeth.
Nynaeve groaned softly. 100 marks, and gold! 100 silver would cover his expenses easily to Gildan and further, whatever those so-called boar horses ate.
You stole that much? Luca said cautiously. Who is after you? I won't risk white cloaks, or the army. They'll throw us all into prison and probably kill the animals.
My brother, Elaine replied, before Nynaeve could angrily deny that they had stolen anything. It seems that a marriage has been arranged while I was away, and my brother was sent to find me. I have no intention of returning to Cairhien to marry a man a head shorter, 3 times my weight and 3 times my age.
Her cheeks colored in only a fair imitation of anger. Her throat clearing did it better.
My father has dreams of claiming the Sun Throne if he can gain enough support. My dreams concern a red-haired Andor man, whom I shall wed, whatever my father says. And that, Master Luca, is as much as you need know of me and more.
Maybe you are who you say you are, Luca said slowly. And maybe you are not. Show me some of this money you claim you'll give me. Promises by small cups of wine.
Angrily, Nynaeve fumbled in her scrip for the fattest purse and shook it at him, then stuffed it out of sight when he reached for it.
You'll get what you need as you need it, and 100 marks after we reach Gildan.
100 marks gold? They would have to find a banker and use those letters of rights if Elaine kept on like this.
Luca gave a sour grunt. Whether you stole that or not, you are still running from somebody. I won't risk my show for you, whether it's the army or some Cairhien and lord who might come looking. The lord might be worse if he thinks I have stolen his sister. You will have to blend in.
That unpleasant smile came on his face again. He was not going to forget that silver penny.
Everyone who travels with me works at something, and you must as well if you mean not to stand out. If the others know you are paying your way, they will talk, and you would not want that. Cleaning the cages will do. The horse handlers are always complaining about having to do that. I'll even find that penny and give it back to you for pay. Never let it be said Valen Luca is not generous.
Nynaeve was about to say in no uncertain terms that they would not pay his way to Gildan and work, too, when Tom laid a hand on her arm. Wordlessly he bent to scuffle up pebbles from the ground, and began juggling them, 6 in a circle.
"I have jugglers," Luca said.
The 6 became 8, then 10, a dozen.
"You are not bad."
The circle became 2, intertwining. Luca rubbed at his chin.
"Maybe I can find a use for you."
"I can also eat fire," Tom said, letting the stones fall. "Perform with knives." He fanned his empty hands, then seemingly pulled a pebble from Luca's ear. "And do a few other things."
Luca suppressed his quick grin. "That does for you, but what about the rest?"
He seemed angry with himself for showing any enthusiasm or approval.
"What is that?" Elaine asked, pointing.
The 2 tall poles Nynaeve had seen being erected now each had ropes to stay it, and a flat platform at its top, with a rope stretched taut over the 30 paces between. A rope ladder hung from each platform.
"That is Cedrin's apparatus," Luca replied, then shook his head. Cedrin the Highwalker, dazzling with feet 10 paces up on a thin rope, the fool.
"I can walk on it," Elaine told him.
Tom reached for her arm as she took off her bonnet and started forward, but he subsided at a small shake of her head and a smile. Luca barred her way, though. "Listen, Morellin, or whatever your name is, your forehead may be too pretty to brand, but your neck is far too pretty to snap. Cedrin knew what he was doing, and we finished burying him not more than an hour ago. That's why everyone is in their wagons. Of course, he drank too much last night, after we were chased out of Sienda, but I've seen him high-walk with a belly full of brandy. I will tell you what. You do not have to clean cages. You move into my wagon, and we will tell everyone you're my lady-love. Just as a tale, of course." His sly smile said he hoped for more than a tale. Elaine's smile in return should have raised frost on him.
"I do thank you for the offer, Master Luca, but if you will kindly step aside..."
He had to, or else have her walk over him. Juelin crumpled that cylindrical hat in his hands, then crammed it back onto his head as she began climbing one of the rope ladders, having a little difficulty with her skirts. Nynaeve knew what the girl was doing. The men should have, and perhaps Tom did at least, but he still looked ready to rush over to catch her if she fell. Luca moved nearer, as though the same thought was in his head. For a moment, Elaine stood on the platform, smoothing her dress. The platform looked much smaller and higher with her on it. Then, delicately holding her skirts up as if to keep them out of mud, she stepped out onto the narrow rope. She might as well have been walking across a street. In a way, Nynaeve knew, she was. She could not see the glow of Sidar, but she knew that Elaine had woven a path between the two platforms, of air, no doubt, turned hard as stone. Abruptly, Elaine put her hands down and turned 2 cartwheels, raven-black hair flailing, silk-stockinged legs flashing in the sun. For the merest instant, as she righted herself, her skirts seemed to brush a flat surface before she snatched them up again. 2 more steps took her to the far platform.
"Did Master Cedrin do that, Master Luca?"
"He did somersaults," he shouted back. In a mutter, he added, "But he did not have legs like that. A lady. Ha!"
"I am not the only one with this skill," Elaine called. "Juelin and—" Nynaeve gave a fierce shake of her head. Channeling or no channeling, her stomach would enjoy that high rope as much as it did a storm at sea. "And I have done this many times. Come on, Juelin, show him." The thief-catcher looked as if he would rather clean the cages with his bare hands. The lions' cages, with the lions inside. He closed his eyes, mouth moving in a silent prayer, and went up the rope ladder in the manner of a man mounting the scaffold. At the top he stared from Elaine to the rope with a fearful concentration. Abruptly he stepped out, walking rapidly, arms stretched out to either side, eyes fixed on Elaine and mouth moving in prayer. She climbed partway down the ladder to make room for him on the platform, then had to help him find the rungs with his feet and guide him down. Tom grinned at her proudly as she came back and took her bonnet from Nynaeve. Juelin looked as if he had been soaked in hot water and wrung out.
"That was good," Luca said, rubbing his chin judiciously. "Not as good as Cedrin, mind, but good. I especially like the way you make it seem so easy, while Juelin pretends to be frightened to death. That will go over very well."
Juelin gave the man a bleak grin that had something of reaching for knives in it. Luca actually swirled that red cape as he turned to Nynaeve. He looked very satisfied indeed.
"And you, my dear Nana, what surprising talent do you have? Tumbling, perhaps? Swallowing swords?"
"I dole out the money," she told him, slapping the scrip.
"Unless you want to offer me your wagon?"
She gave him a smile that wiped his clean away and backed him up 2 steps besides. The shouting had roused people from the wagons, and everyone gathered around while Luca introduced the troop's new performers. He was rather vague about Nynaeve, merely calling what she did startling. She needed to have a talk with him. The horse handlers, as Luca called the men who had no performing talent, were a scruffy, surly lot in general, perhaps because they were paid less. There were not very many of them, compared to the number of wagons. In fact, it turned out that everyone helped with the work, including driving the wagons. There was not much money in a traveling menagerie, even one like this. The others were a mixed lot. Petra, the strong man, was the biggest man Nynaeve had ever seen. Not tall, but wide. His leather vest showed arms the size of tree trunks. He was married to Clarine, the plump, brown-cheeked woman who trained dogs. She looked undersized beside him. Latel, who performed with the bears, was a stern-faced, dark-eyed woman with short black hair and the beginnings of a sneer permanently on her lips. Aludra, the slender woman who was supposed to be an illuminator, might even have been one. She did not wear her dark hair in Tarabonner braids, not surprising given the feelings in Amadisia, but she had the proper accents, and who could say what had happened to the Guild of Illuminators? Their chapter house in Tanchico had certainly closed its doors. The acrobats, on the other hand, claimed to be brothers named Chavanna, but though they were all short, compact men, they ranged in coloring from green-eyed Taeric, his high cheekbones and hooked nose proclaiming Saldaean blood, to Barret, who was darker than Julian and had seafolk tattoos on his hands, though he wore no earrings or nose rings. All but Latel greeted the newcomers warmly. More performers meant more people attracted to the show, and more money. The two jugglers, Barry and Kin, they really were brothers, it turned out, engaged Tom in talk of their trade, once they found out that he did not work the same way they did. Drawing more people was one thing, competition another. Yet it was the pale-haired woman who cared for the boar horses who attracted Nynaeve's immediate interest. Sarandon stood stiffly on the fringes and barely spoke. Luca claimed she had come from Shara with the animals, but her soft, slurred manner of speech made Nynaeve's ears go to points. It took a little time to get their wagon in place. Tom and Julian seemed more than pleased to have the horse handlers help with the team, sullenly as it was given, and invitations were given to Nynaeve and Elaine. Petra and Clarine asked them to have tea once they were settled. The Chavannas wanted the two women to have supper with them, and Kin and Barry did too, all of which made Latel's sneer become a scowl. Those invitations they declined gracefully, Elaine perhaps a bit more so than Nynaeve. The memory of herself goggling at Galad like a frog-eyed girl was too fresh for her to be more than minimally polite to any man. Luca had his own invitation for Elaine alone, spoken where Nynaeve could not hear. It earned him a slapped face, and Tom ostentatiously flashed knives that seemed to roll across his hands until the man went away growling to himself and rubbing his cheek. Leaving Elaine putting her things away in the wagon, throwing them, really, and muttering to herself furiously, Nynaeve went off to where the boar horses were hobbled. The huge gray animal seemed placid enough, but remembering that hole in the stone wall of the King's Lancer, she was not too sure about the leather cords connecting their massive front legs. Sarandon was scratching the big male with her bronze-hooked goad. "What are they called?" Diffidently, Nynaeve patted the male's long nose, or snout, or whatever it was. Those tusks were as big around as her leg and a good 3 paces longer, and only a little larger than the female's at that. The snout snuffled at her skirt, and she stepped back hastily.
"Sridit," the pale-haired woman said. "They are Sridit, but Master Luca thought a name more easily said was better."
That drawling accent was unmistakable.
"Are there many Sridit in Shanchan?"
The goad stopped moving for an instant, then resumed scratching.
"Shanchan? Where is that?"
"The Sridit are from Shara, as I am. I have never heard of..."
"Perhaps you've seen Shara, Sarandon, but I doubt it. You are Shanchan. Unless I miss my guess, you were part of the invasion on Toman Head, left behind after Falma."
"There is no doubt," Elaine said, stepping up beside her. "We heard Shanchan accents in Falma, Sarandon. We will not hurt you."
That was more than Nynaeve was willing to promise. Her memories of the Shanchan were not fond ones. And yet,
Ashanchan helped you when you needed it. They are not all evil, only most of them.
Sarandon let out a long sigh and sagged a little. It was as if a tension so old that she was no longer aware of it had gone.
Very few people I have met know anything approaching the truth of the Return, or Falma. I have heard 100 tales, each more fanciful than the last, but never the truth. As well for me. I was left behind, and many of the Sri did also. These three were all I could gather. I do not know what happened to the rest. The bull is Mare, the cow Sanit, and the calf Nerin. She is not Sanit's.
Is that what you did? Elaine asked. Train Sridit?
Or were you a Suldam? Nynaeve added before the other woman could speak.
Sarandon shook her head.
I was tested, as all girls are, but I could do nothing with the Eidam. I was glad to be chosen to work with Sridit. They are magnificent animals. You know a great deal to know of Suldam and Domani. I have encountered no one before who knows of them.
She showed no fear.
Or perhaps it had been used up since finding herself abandoned in a strange land. Then again, maybe she was lying.
The Shanshan were as bad as Amadisians when it came to women who could channel, perhaps worse. They did not exile or kill, they imprisoned and used. By means of a device called an Eidam, Nynaeve was sure it must be a sort of Turang Rial. A woman who had the ability to wield the one power could be controlled by another woman, a Suldam, who forced the Domani to use her talents for whatever the Shanchan wanted, even as a weapon. A Domani was no better than an animal, if a well-tended one, and they made Domani of every last woman found with the ability to channel or the spark born in her. The Shanchan had scoured Toman Head more thoroughly than the tower had ever dreamed of. The mere thought of Eidam and Suldam and Domani made Nynaeve's stomach churn.
"We know a little," she told Sarandon, "but we want to know more."
The Shanchan were gone, driven away by Rand, but that was not to say they would not return one day. It was a distant danger beside everything else they had to face, yet just because you had a thorn in your foot did not mean that a briar scratch on your arm would not fester eventually.
You would do well to answer our questions truthfully. There would be time on the journey north.
I promise that nothing will happen to you, Elaine added. I will protect you, if need be.
The pale-haired woman's eyes shifted from one of them to the other, and suddenly, to Nynaeve's amazement, she prostrated herself on the ground in front of Elaine.
You are a high lady of this land, just as you told Luca. I did not realize. Forgive me, high lady. I submit myself to you.
And she kissed the ground in front of Elaine's feet. Elaine's eyes looked ready to leap out of her face. Nynaeve was sure she was no better.
Get up, she hissed, looking around frantically to see if anyone was watching.
Luca was, curse him, and Latrell, still wearing that scowl, but there was nothing to be done.
Get up!
The woman did not stir.
Stand on your feet, Sarandon, Elaine said.
No one requires people to behave that way in this land, not even a ruler.
As Sarandon scrambled erect, she added, I will teach you the proper way to behave in return for your answers to our questions.
The woman bowed, hands on her knees and head down.
Yes, High Lady, it will be as you say. I'm yours.
Nynaeve sighed heavily. They were going to have a fine time traveling to Gildan.
Chapter 18. A Hound of Darkness.
Leandrin guided her horse through the crowded streets of Amador, the sneer on her rosebud lips hidden by her deep, curving bonnet. She had hated to give up her multitude of braids, and hated even more the ludicrous fashions of this ludicrous land. The reddish-yellow of hat and riding dress she rather liked, but not the large velvet bows on both. Still, the bonnet hid her eyes. Combined with honey-yellow hair, brown eyes would have named her a Tarabonner in an instant. Not a good thing in Amadisia just now.
and it hid what would have been even worse to show here, an Aes Sedai's face. Safely hidden, she could smirk at the white cloaks, who seemed to be every fifth man in the streets. Not that the soldiers who made another fifth would have been any better. None of them ever thought to look inside the bonnet, of course. Aes Sedai were outlawed here, and that meant there were none. Even so, she felt a little better when she turned in at the elaborate iron gates in front of Jorin Arine's house. Another fruitless trip looking for word from the White Tower. There had been nothing since she had learned that Elida thought she was in control of the tower, and that the Shanche woman had been disposed of. Swan had escaped, true, but she was a useless rag now. The gardens behind the grey stone fence were full of plants, going rather brown from lack of rain, but trimmed and trained into cubes and balls, though one was shaped like a leaping horse. Only one, of course. Merchants like Arine mimicked their betters, but they dared not go too far lest someone think their conceit too high. Elaborate balconies decorated the large wooden house with its red-tiled roofs, and even a colonnade of carved columns, but unlike the lord's dwelling it was meant to copy, it stood on a stone foundation no more than 10 feet tall, a childish pretense at a noble's manor. The stringy grey-haired man who scurried out deferentially to hold her stirrup while she dismounted and take her reins was clad all in black. Whatever colours a merchant chose for livery, they were sure to be some real lord's colours, and even a minor lord could cause trouble for the richest seller of goods. People in the streets called black merchant's livery, and snickered when they said it. Leandrin despised the groom's black coat as much as she did Arine's house and Arine himself. She would have true manners one day, palaces. They had been promised to her, and the power that went with them. Stripping off her riding gloves, she stalked up the ridiculous ramp that slanted along the foundations to the vine-carved front doors. The lord's fortress manors had ramps, so of course a merchant who thought well of himself could not have steps. A black-clad young serving girl took gloves and hat in the round entrance hall, with its many doors and carved and brightly painted columns and its encircling balcony. The ceiling was lacquered in imitation of a mosaic, stars within stars in gold and black. "I will have my bath in 1 hour," she told the woman. "It will be the proper temperature this time, yes?" The maid went pale as she curtsied, stammering agreement before scurrying away. Amelia Arine, Jorin's wife, came through one of the doors deep in conversation with a fat, balding man in a spotless white apron. Leandrin breathed contemptuously. The woman had pretensions, yet she not only spoke to the cook herself, she brought the man out of his kitchens to discuss meals. She treated the servant like a friend. Fat Evan saw her first and gulped, his piggy eyes darting away immediately. She did not like men looking at her, and she had spoken sharply to him on her first day here about the way his gaze sometimes lingered. He had tried to deny it, but she knew men's vile habits. Without waiting to be dismissed by his mistress, Evan all but ran back the way he had come. The graying merchant's wife had been a stern-faced woman when Leandrin and the others came. Now she licked her lips and smoothed her bow-draped green silk needlessly. "There is someone upstairs with the others, my lady," she said diffidently. She had thought that she could use Leandrin's name that first day. "In the front withdrawing-room... from Tarvalen, I believe." Wondering who it could be, Leandrin started for the nearest of the curving staircases. She knew few others of the Black Aja, of course, for safety's sake. What others did not know, they could not betray. In the tower she had known only one of the 12 who went with her when she left. 2 of the 12 were dead, and she knew at whose feet to lay the blame. Egwene Alvear, Nynaeve Almira, and Elaine Trakand. Everything had gone so badly in Tanchico that she would have thought those 3 upstart accepted had been there, except that they were fools who had twice walked tamely into traps she had set. That they had escaped each was of no consequence. Had they been in Tanchico, they would have fallen into her hands, whatever Gianna claimed to have seen. The next time she found them, they would never escape anything again. She would be done with them, whatever her orders. "My lady," Amelia stammered. "My husband, my lady.
Jorin, please will one of you help him? He did not mean it, my lady. He has learned his lesson.
Leandrin paused with one hand on the carved banister, looking back over her shoulder. He should not have thought that his oaths to the great lord could be conveniently forgotten, no?
He has learned, my lady. Please. He lies beneath blankets all day, in this heat, shivering. He weeps when anyone touches him or speaks above a whisper.
Leandrin paused as if considering, then nodded graciously.
I will ask Chesmal to see what she can do. Yet you understand that I make no promises.
The woman's unsteady thanks followed her up, but she paid them no mind. Tamila had let herself be carried away. She had been gray Aja before becoming black, and she always made a point of spreading the pain evenly when she mediated. She had been very successful as a mediator, for she liked spreading pain. Chesmal said he might be able to do small tasks in a few months, so long as they were not too hard, and no one raised a voice. She had been one of the best healers in generations among the Yellow, so she should know. The front withdrawing room startled her when she went in. 9 of the 10 black sisters who had come with her stood around the room against the carved and painted paneling, though there were plenty of silk-cushioned chairs on the gold-fringed carpet. The 10th, Tamila Kinderroda, was handing a delicate porcelain cup of tea to a dark-haired, sturdily handsome woman in a bronze-colored gown of unfamiliar cut. The seated woman looked vaguely familiar, though she was not Aes Sedai. She was plainly approaching her middle years, and despite smooth cheeks, there was nothing of agelessness about her. Yet the mood made Leandrin cautious. Tamila was deceptively fragile in appearance, with big childlike blue eyes that made people trust her. Those eyes appeared worried now, or uneasy, and the teacup rattled on the saucer before the other woman took it. Every face looked uneasy, except that of the oddly familiar woman. Coppery-skinned Gianna Kaida, in one of those disgusting Domani garments that she wore inside the house, had tears still glistening on her cheeks. She had been a green, and liked flaunting herself in front of men even more than most greens. Rihanna Andomuran, once white and always a coldly arrogant killer, nervously kept touching the pale streak in her black hair above her left ear. Her arrogance had been flattened.
"What has happened here?" Leandrin demanded. "Who are you and what—"
Suddenly the memory flashed into her head. A dark friend, a servant in Tanchico who had continually gotten above herself.
"Gildin!" she snapped. This servant had followed them in some fashion, and obviously was trying to pass herself off as a black courier with some dire news. "You have overstepped yourself too far this time."
She reached to embrace Sidar, yet even as she did, the glow surrounded the other woman, and Leandrin's reach ran into a thick, invisible wall, shutting her away from the source. It hung there like the sun, tantalizingly out of reach.
"Stop gaping, Leandrin," the woman said calmly. "You look like a fish. It is not Gildin, but Mogadine.
This tea needs more honey, Tamila." The slender, fox-faced woman darted to take the cup, breathing heavily.
It had to be so. Who else could have so cowed the others?
Leandrin looked at them standing around the walls. Round-faced, Eldrith Jondar, for once not looking vague at all despite an ink smudge on her nose, nodded vigorously. The others seemed afraid to twitch. Why one of the Forsaken? They were not supposed to use that name, but usually did among themselves. Why Mogadine would have masqueraded as a servant, she could not understand. The woman had, or could have, everything that she herself wanted. Not just knowledge of the one power beyond her dreams, but power. Power over others, power over the world, and immortality. Power for a lifetime that would never end. She and her sisters had speculated on dissension among the Forsaken. There had been orders at odds with each other, and orders given to other dark friends at odds with theirs. Perhaps Mogadine had been hiding from the rest of the Forsaken. Leandrin spread her divided riding skirts as best she could in a deep curtsy.
"We welcome you, great mistress. With the chosen to lead us, we shall surely triumph before the day of the great lord's return."
"'Nicely said,' Morgadine said dryly, taking the cup back from Tamila. "'Yes, this is much better.' Tamila looked absurdly grateful and relieved. What had Morgadine done? Suddenly a thought came to Leandrin, an unwelcome one. She had treated one of the chosen as a servant. "'Great mistress, in Tanchico I did not know that you—' "'Of course you did not,' Morgadine said irritably. "'What good to bide my time in the shadows if you and these others knew me?' Abruptly a small smile appeared on her lips. It touched nothing else. "'Are you worried about those times you sent Gildin to the cook to be beaten?' Sweat beaded suddenly on Leandrin's face. "'Do you truly believe I would allow such a thing? The man no doubt reported to you, but he remembered what I wanted him to remember. He actually felt sorry for Gildin, so cruelly treated by her mistress. That seemed to amuse her greatly.' He gave me some of the desserts that he made for you. It would not displease me if he still lives. Leandrin drew a relieved breath. She would not die. Great mistress, there is no need to shield me. I also serve the great lord. I swore my oaths as a dark friend before ever I went to the White Tower. I sought the Black Aja from the day that I knew that I could channel. So you will be the only one in this ill-ordered pack who does not need to learn who her mistress is? Morgadine quirked an eyebrow. I would not have thought it of you. The glow around her vanished. I have tasks for you, for all of you. Whatever you have been doing, you will forget. You are an inept lot, as you proved in Tanchico. With my hand on the dog whip, perhaps you will hunt more successfully. We await orders from the tower, great mistress, Leandrin said. Inept? They had almost found what they were hunting for in Tanchico when the city exploded in riots. They had barely escaped destruction at the hands of Aes Sedai, who had somehow wandered into the middle of their plan. Had Morgadine revealed herself, or even taken part on their behalf, they would have triumphed. If their failure was anyone's fault, it was Mogadine's herself. Leandrin reached toward the true source, not to embrace it, but to be certain that the shield had not merely been tied off. It was gone. We have been given great responsibilities, great works to prove, and surely we will be commanded to continue. Morgadine cut her off sharply. You serve whichever of the chosen chooses to snap you up. Whoever sends you orders from the White Tower, she takes her own from one of us now. "'And very likely grovels on her belly when she does. "'You will serve me, Leandrin. "'Be sure of it.' "'Mogadine did not know who headed the Black Aja. "'It was a revelation. "'Mogadine did not know everything. "'Leandrin had always imagined the Forsaken as close to omnipotent, "'something far beyond ordinary mortals. "'Perhaps the woman truly was in flight from the other Forsaken.' To hand her over to them would surely earn her a high place. She might even become one of them. She had a trick, learned in childhood, and she could touch the source. Great mistress, we serve the great lord as you do. We also were promised eternal life and power when the great lord Do you think that you are my equal, little sister? Morgadine grimaced in disgust. Did you stand in the pit of doom to dedicate your soul to the great lord? Did you taste the sweetness of victory at Parandizen, or the bitter ashes at the Aesar Dawn? You are a barely trained puppy, not the pack mistress, and you will go where I point until I see fit to give you a better place. These others thought themselves more than they are, too. Do you wish to try your strength against me? Of course not, great mistress. Not when she was forewarned and ready. You will do so sooner or later, and I prefer to put it out of the way now in the beginning. Why do you think your companions look so cheerful? I have taught each of them the same lesson already today. I will not wonder when you must be taught too. I will be done with it now. Try. Licking her lips fearfully, Leandrin looked around at the women standing rigidly against the walls. Only Asni Zaramine so much as blinked, she shook her head ever so slightly.
Asni's tilted eyes, high cheekbones, and strong nose marked her Saldaean, and she had all the vaunted Saldaean boldness. If she counseled against, if her dark eyes held a tinge of fear, then it was surely best to grovel, however much was needed to make Mogadine relent. And yet, there was her trick. She went to her knees, head low, looking up at the Forsaken with a fear that was only partly feigned. Mogadine lounged in her chair, sipping the tea. "Great mistress, I beg you to forgive me if I have presumed. I know that I am but a worm beneath your foot. I beg, as one who would be your faithful hound, for your mercy on this wretched dog." Mogadine's eyes dropped to her cup, and in a flash, while the words still tumbled from her mouth, Leandrin embraced the source and channeled, seeking the crack that must be in the Forsaken's confidence, the crack that was in everyone's facade of strength. Even as she lashed out, the light of Saidar surrounded the other woman and pain enveloped Leandrin. She crumpled to the carpet, trying to howl, but agony beyond anything she had ever known silenced her gaping mouth. Her eyes were going to burst from her head. Her skin was going to peel away in strips. For an eternity she thrashed, and when it vanished as suddenly as it had begun, all she could do was lie there, shuddering and weeping open-mouthed. "Do you begin to see?" Mogadine said calmly, handing the empty cup to Tamila with, "That was very good, but next time a little stronger." Tamila looked as though she might faint. "You are not quick enough, Leandrin. You are not strong enough, and you do not know enough. That pitiful little thing you tried against me. Would you like to see what it is really like?" she channeled. Leandrin gazed up at her adoringly. Crawling across the floor, she pushed words through the sobs she still could not stop. "Forgive me, great mistress!" This magnificent woman, like a star in the heavens, a comet, above all kings and queens in wonder. "Forgive, please," she begged, pressing kisses against the hem of Mogadine's skirt as she babbled. "Forgive! I am a dog, a worm." It shamed her to her core that she had not meant those things before. They were true. Before this woman, they were all true. "Let me serve you, great mistress. Allow me to serve. Please, please." "I am not Graindal," Mogadine said, pushing her away roughly with one velvet-slippered foot. Suddenly the sense of worship was gone. Lying there in a heap, weeping, Leandrin could remember it clearly, though. She stared at the Forsaken in horror. "Are you convinced yet, Leandrin?"
"Yes, great mistress," she managed.
She was. Convinced that she dared not even think of trying again until she was certain of success. Her trick was only the palest shadow of what Mogadine had done. Could she but learn that? "We shall see. I think you may be one of those who needs a second lesson. Pray it is not so, Leandrin. I make second lessons exceedingly sharp. Now take your place with the others. You will find that I have taken some of the objects of power that you had in your room, but you may keep the trinkets that remain. Am I not kind?"
"The great mistress is kind,"
Leandrin agreed, around hiccups and occasional sobs that she could not stifle. Limply, she staggered to her feet and went to stand beside Asni. The wall panel against her back helped to hold her upright. She saw the flows of air being woven. Only air, but she still flinched as they bound her mouth shut and stopped sound from her ears. She certainly did not try to resist. She did not even let herself think of Saidar. Who knew what one of the Forsaken could do? Perhaps read her thoughts. That almost made her run. No. If Mogadine knew her thoughts, she would be dead by now, or still screaming on the floor, or kissing Mogadine's feet and begging to serve. Leandrin shivered uncontrollably. If that weave had not bound her mouth, her teeth would have been chattering. Mogadine wove the same around all of them, save Rihanna, whom the Forsaken beckoned with an imperious finger to kneel before her. Then Rihanna left, and Marilyn Gamalfin was unbound and summoned. From where she stood, Leandrin could see their faces, even if their mouths moved soundlessly for her. Plainly each woman was receiving orders the others knew nothing of. The faces told little, though. Rihanna merely listened, a touch of relief in her eyes, bowed her head in assent, and went. Marilyn looked surprised and then eager, but she had been a Brown, and Browns could be enthusiastic over anything that allowed them a chance to unearth some moldy bit of lost knowledge. Gianna Kaida donned a slow mask of horror, shaking her head at first, and trying to cover herself in that disgustingly sheer gown, but Mogadine's face hardened, and Gianna nodded hurriedly and fled, if not as eagerly as Marilyn, just as quickly. Barilla Naron, lean almost to scrawniness and as fine a manipulator and plotter as there was, and Phelan Boda, long-faced and cold despite her obvious fear, showed as little expression as Rihanna had. Ispan Shafar, like Leandrin from Tarabon, though dark-haired, actually kissed Mogadine's hem before she rose. Then the flows were unwoven around Leandrin. She thought that it was her turn to be sent away on the shadow-knew-what errand, until she saw the bonds dispelled around the others remaining as well. Mogadine's finger beckoned peremptorily, and Leandrin knelt between Asni and Chesmal Emery, a tall, handsome woman, dark-haired and dark-eyed. Chesmal, once yellow, could heal or kill with equal ease, but the intensity of her gaze on Mogadine, the way her hands trembled as they clutched her skirts, said she intended only to obey. She would have to go by such signs, Leandrin realized, approaching one of the others with her belief that rewards could be had for handing Mogadine to the rest of the Forsaken might well be disastrous if the one she spoke to had decided that it was in her best interests to be Mogadine's lapdog. She almost whimpered at the thought of a second lesson. "You, I keep with me," the Forsaken said, "for the most important task. What the others do may bear sweet fruit, but to me yours will be the most important harvest. A personal harvest. There is a woman named Nynaeve Almira." Leandrin's head came up and Mogadine's dark eyes sharpened. "You know of her?" "I despise her," Leandrin replied truthfully. "She is a filthy wilder who ought never to have been allowed in the tower." She loathed all wilders. Dreaming of being Black Aja, she herself had begun learning to channel a full year before going to the tower, but she was in no way a wilder. "Very good. You five are going to find her for me. I want her alive. Oh, yes, I do want her alive." Mogadine's smile made Leandrin shiver. Giving Nynaeve and the other two to her might be entirely suitable. The day before yesterday she was in a village called Sienda, perhaps 60 miles east of here, with another young woman in whom I may be interested, but they have vanished. You will— Leandrin listened eagerly. For this she could be a faithful hound. For the other, she would wait patiently. Chapter 19. Memories. "My queen." Morgaze looked up from the book on her lap. Sunlight slanted through the window of the sitting room next to her bedchamber. The day was already hot, with no breeze, and sweat dampened her face. It would be noon before much longer, and she had not stirred from the room. That was unlike her. She could not remember why she had decided to laze the morning away with a book. She seemed unable to concentrate on reading of late. By the golden clock on the mantel above the marble fireplace, an hour had passed since she last turned a page, and she could not recall its words. It must be the heat. The red-coated young officer of her guards, kneeling with one fist pressed to the red and gold carpet, looked vaguely familiar. Once she had known the name of every guard assigned to the palace. Perhaps it was all the new faces. "Talanvor," she said, surprising herself. He was a tall, well-made young man, but she could not tell why she remembered him in particular. Had he brought someone to her once? Long ago? Guardsman Lieutenant Martine Talanvor. He glanced at her, startlingly rough-eyed, before putting his gaze back on the carpet. "My queen, forgive me, but I am surprised that you remain here given the morning's news."
"What news?"
It would be good to learn something besides Altema's gossip of the Tyran court. At times she felt that there was something else she wanted to ask the woman, but all they ever did was gossip, which she could never remember doing before. Gabriel seemed to enjoy listening to them, sitting in that tall chair in front of the fireplace with his ankles crossed, smiling contentedly. Altema had taken to wearing rather daring dresses. Morgays would have to say something to her. Dimly she seemed to remember thinking that before. Nonsense. If I had, I would have spoken to her already. She shook her head, realizing that she had drifted away from the young officer entirely, that he had begun speaking and stopped when he saw she was not listening. "Tell me again. I was distracted. And stand." He rose, face angry, eyes burning on her before they dropped again. She looked where he had been staring and blushed. Her dress was cut extremely low, but Gabriel liked her to wear them so. With that thought, she ceased fretting about being nearly naked in front of one of her officers. "Be brief," she said curtly. "How dare he look at me in that manner? I should have him flogged. What news is so important that you think you can walk into my sitting room as if it were a tavern?" His face darkened, but whether from proper embarrassment or increased anger, she could not say. "How dare he be angry with his queen? Does the man think all I have to do is listen to him?" "Rebellion, my queen," he said in a flat tone, and all thought of anger and stares vanished. "Where?" "The two rivers, my queen. Someone has raised the old banner of Manetheron, the Red Eagle. A messenger came from Whitebridge this morning." Morgays drummed her fingers on the book, her thoughts coming more clearly than it seemed they had in a very long time. Something about the two rivers, some spark she could not quite fan to life, tugged at her. The region was hardly part of Andor at all, and had not been for generations. She and the last three queens before her had been hard-pressed to maintain a modicum of control over the miners and smelters in the Mountains of Mist, and even that modicum would have been lost had there been any way to get the metals out save through the rest of Andor. A choice between holding the mines' gold and iron and other metals and keeping the two rivers' wool and tabak had not been difficult. But rebellion unchecked, even rebellion in a part of her realm that she ruled only on a map, could spread like wildfire to places that were hers in fact. And Manetheron, destroyed in the Trolloc Wars, Manetheron of legend and story, still had a hold on some men's minds. Besides, the two rivers was hers. If they had been left to go their own way for far too long, they were still a part of her realm. Has Lord Gabriel been informed? Of course he had not. He would have come to her with the news and suggestions on how to deal with it. His suggestions were always clearly right. Suggestions? Somehow it seemed that she could remember him telling her what to do. That was impossible, of course.
"He has, my queen." Talonvor's voice was still bland, unlike his face, where slow anger yet smoldered. "He laughed. He said the two rivers seemed to throw up trouble, and he would have to do something about it one day. He said this minor annoyance would have to wait its turn behind more important matters."
The book fell as she sprang to her feet, and she thought Talonvor smiled in grim satisfaction as she swept by him. A serving woman told her where Gabriel was to be found, and she marched straight to the colonnaded court with its marble fountain, the basin full of lily pads and fish. It was cooler there and shaded a little. Gabriel sat on the broad white coping of the fountain, lords and ladies gathered around him. She recognized fewer than half. Dark, square-faced Jared of House Sarand and his shrewish, honey-haired wife, Elenia. That simpering Aramilla of House Marn, melting brown eyes always so wide in feigned interest, and bony goat-faced Massin of House Caron, who would tumble any woman he could corner despite his thin white hair. Nayan of House Aron, as usual with a sneer marring her pale beauty, and Lear of House Barin, a whip of a man, wearing a sword of all things, and Karind of House Anshar, with the same flat-eyed stare that some said had put three husbands under the ground. The others she did not know at all, which was strange enough. But these she never allowed into the palace, except on state occasions. Every one had opposed her during the succession. Elenia and Nayan had wanted the Lion Throne for themselves. What could Gabriel be thinking to actually bring them here?
The size of our estates in Kyrian, my lord,
Aramilla was saying, leaning over Gabriel as more gaze approached. None of them more than glanced at her, as if she were a servant with the wine. I want to speak with you concerning the two rivers, Gabriel, in private.
It has been dealt with, my dear, he said idly, dabbling his fingers in the water. Other matters concern me now. I thought you were going to read during the heat of the day. You should return to your room until the evening's coolness, such as it is.
My dear. He had called her my dear in front of these interlopers. As much as she thrilled to hear that on his lips when they were alone, Elenia was hiding her mouth. I think not, Lord Gabriel, Morgaze said coldly. You will come with me now, and these others will be out of the palace before I return, or I will exile them from Camelin completely. Suddenly he was on his feet, a big man, towering over her. She seemed unable to look at anything but his dark eyes. Her skin tingled as if an icy wind were blowing through the courtyard.
You will go and wait for me, Morgaze.
His voice was a distant roar filling her ears.
I have dealt with all that needs dealing with. I will come to you this evening. You will go now. You will go.
She had one hand lifted to open the door of her sitting room before she realized where she was and what had happened. He had told her to go, and she had gone. Staring at the door in horror, she could see the smirks on the men's faces, open laughter on some of the women's.
What has happened to me? How could I become so besotted with any man?
She still felt the urge to enter and wait for him. Dazed, she forced herself to turn and walk away. It was an effort. Inside, she cringed at the idea of Gabriel's disappointment in her when he did not find her where he expected, and cringed further at recognizing the fawning thought. At first, she had no notion of where she was going or why, only that she would not wait obediently, not for Gabriel, not for any man or woman in the world. The fountained courtyard kept repeating in her head, him telling her to go, and those hateful, amused faces watching. Her mind still seemed fogged. She could not comprehend how or why she could have let it happen. She had to think of something that she could understand, something she could deal with, Jared Sarand and the others. When she assumed the throne, she had pardoned them for everything they had done during the succession, as she had pardoned everyone who opposed her. It had seemed best to bury all animosities before they could fester into the sort of plotting and scheming that infected so many lands. The Game of Houses, it was called, Desdemar, or the Great Game, and it led to endless tangled feuds between houses, to the toppling of rulers. The game was at the heart of the civil war in Kyrian, and no doubt had done its part in the turmoil enveloping Arad-Domon and Tarabon. The pardons had had to go to all to stop Desdemar being born in Andor, but could she have left any unsigned, they would have been the parchments with those seven's names. Gabriel knew that. Publicly, she had shown no disfavor, but in private she had been willing to speak of her distrust. They had had to pry their jaws open to swear fealty, and she could hear the lie on their tongues. Any one would leap at a chance to pull her down, and all seven together. There was only one conclusion she could reach. Gabriel must be plotting against her. It could not be to put Elenia or Nain on the throne. Not when he has me already, she thought bitterly, behaving like his lapdog. He must mean to supplant her himself, to become the first king that Andor had ever had. And she still felt the desire to return to her book and wait for him. She still ached for his touch. It was not until she saw the aged faces in the hallway around her, the creased cheeks and often bent backs, that she became aware of where she was, the pensioners' quarters. Some servants returned to their families when they grew old, but others had been so long in the palace that they could think of no other life. Here they had their own small apartments, their own shaded garden, and a spacious courtyard. Like every queen before her, she supplemented their pensions by letting them buy food through the palace kitchens for less than its cost, and the infirmary treated their ills. Creaky bows and unsteady curtsies followed her, and murmurs of, "The light shine upon you, my queen," and, "The light bless you, my queen," and,
the light protect you, my queen."
She acknowledged them absently. She knew where she was going now. Lini's door was like all the others along the green-tiled corridor, unadorned save for a carving of the rearing Lion of Andor. She never thought of knocking before entering. She was the queen, and this was her palace. Her old nurse was not there, though a tea kettle steaming over a small fire in the brick fireplace said she would not be long. The two snug rooms were neatly furnished, the bed made to perfection, the two chairs precisely aligned at the table, where a blue vase in the exact center held a small fan of greenery. Lini had always been a great one for neatness. Morghese was willing to wager that within the wardrobe in the bedchamber, every dress was arranged just so with every other, and the same for pots in the cupboard beside the fireplace in the other room. Six painted ivory miniatures in small wooden stands made a line on the mantelpiece. How Lini could have afforded them on a nurse's stipend was more than Morghese had ever been able to imagine. She could not ask such a question, of course. In pairs they showed three young women, and the same three as babes. Elaine was there, and herself. Taking down the portrait of herself at 14, a slender filly of a girl, she could not believe that she had ever looked so innocent. She had worn that ivory silk dress the day she had gone to the White Tower, never dreaming at the time that she would be queen, only harboring the vain hope that she might become Aes Sedai. Absent-mindedly, she thumbed the great serpent ring on her left hand. She had not earned that, precisely. Women who could not channel were not awarded the ring. But short of her 16th name day, she had returned to contest the rose crown in the name of House Trakand, and when she won the throne nearly 2 years later, the ring had been presented to her. By tradition, the daughter heir of Andor always trained in the tower, and in recognition of Andor's long support of the tower, was given the ring, whether or not she could channel. She had only been the heir to House Trakand in the tower, but they gave it to her anyway, once the rose crown was on her head. Replacing her own portrait, she took down her mother's, taken at perhaps 2 years older. Lini had been nurse to three generations of Trakand women. Maegdin Trakand had been beautiful. Morghese could remember that smile, when it had become a mother's loving beam. It was Maegdin who should have had the lion throne, but a fever had carried her away, and a young girl had found herself high seat of House Trakand, in the middle of a struggle for the throne, with no more support in the beginning than her house retainers and the house bard. "I won the lion throne. I will not give it up, and I will not see a man take it. For 1,000 years a queen has ruled Andor, and I will not let that end now."
"Meddling in my things again, are you, child?"
That voice triggered long-forgotten reflexes. Morghese had the miniature hidden behind her back before she knew it. With a rueful shake of her head, she put the portrait back on its stand. "I am not a girl in the nursery any longer, Lini. You must remember that, or one day you will say something where I must do something about it."
"My neck is scrawny and old," Lini said, setting a net bag of carrots and turnips on the table.
She looked frail in her neat gray dress, her white hair drawn back in a bun from a narrow face with skin like thin parchment. But her back was straight, her voice clear and steady, and her dark eyes as sharp as ever.
"If you want to give it to a hangman or headsman, I am almost done with it anyway. A gnarled old branch dulls the blade that severs a sapling."
Morghese sighed. Lini would never change. She would not curtsy if the entire court were watching. "You do grow tougher as you grow older. I am not certain a headsman could find an axe sharp enough for your neck."
"You've not been to see me in some time, so I suppose there's something you need to work out in your mind. When you were in the nursery, and later, you always used to come to me when you couldn't work matters out. Shall I make a pot of tea?"
"Some time, Lini? I visit you every week, and a wonder I do, given how you speak to me. I would exile the highest lady in Andor if she said half what you do." Lini gave her a level look.
"You have not darkened my doorway since the spring. And I talk as I always have.
I'm too old to change now.
Do you want tea?
No.
Morghese put a hand to her head in confusion. She did visit Lini every week. She could remember. She could not remember. Gabriel had filled her hours so completely that sometimes it was hard to remember anything other than him.
No, I do not want tea. I do not know why I came. You cannot help me with the problem I have.
Her old nurse snorted, though somehow she made it a delicate sound.
Your trouble is with Gabriel, isn't it? Only now you're ashamed to tell me. Girl, I changed you in your cradle, tended you when you were sick and heaving your stomach up, and told you what you needed to know about men. You've never been too ashamed to discuss anything with me, and now is no time to begin.
Gabriel? Morghese's eyes widened. You know? But how?
Oh, child, Lini said sadly. Everyone knows, though no one's had the courage to tell you. I might have if you hadn't stayed away, but it is hardly something I could go running to you with now, is it? It is the kind of thing a woman won't believe until she finds out for herself.
What are you talking about? Morghese demanded. It was your duty to come to me if you knew, Lini. It was everyone's duty. Light, I am the last to know, and now it may be too late to stop it.
Too late? Lini said incredulously. Why should it be too late? You bundle Gabriel out of the palace, out of Andor, and Al-Tama and the others with him, and it is done with. Too late, indeed.
For a moment, Morghese could not speak.
Al-Tama? She said finally. And the others?
Lini stared at her, then shook her head in disgust. I am an old fool. My wits are dry-rooted.
Well, you know now. When the honey's out of the comb, there's no putting it back.
Her voice became gentler, and at the same time brisk, the voice she had used for telling Morghese that her pony had broken a leg and had to be put down.
Gabriel spends most of his nights with you, but Al-Tama has nearly as much of his time. He spreads himself thin with the other six. Five have rooms in the palace. One, a big-eyed young thing, he sneaks in and out for some reason, all swathed in a cloak, even in this heat. Perhaps she has a husband. I'm sorry, girl, but truth is truth. Better to face the bear than run from it.
Morghese's knees sagged, and if Lini had not hurriedly pulled a chair from the table to shove under her, she would have sat down on the floor. Al-Tama. Him watching the two of them as they gossiped took on a new image now. A man fondly watching two of his pet cats at play.
And six others! Rage boiled up in her, a rage that had been lacking when she only thought he was after her throne.
That she had considered coldly, clearly, as clearly as she could consider anything recently. That was a danger that had to be looked at with cold reason.
But this! The man had ensconced his jades in her palace. He had made her just another of his trulls. She wanted his head. She wanted him flayed alive.
The light helper she wanted his touch.
I must be going mad.
That will be solved, along with everything else, she said coldly. Much depended on who was in Camelin, and who on their country estates. Where is Lord Pellivar? Lord Abel? Lady Arathel. They led strong houses, and many retainers.
Exiled, Lini said slowly, giving her an odd look. You exiled them from the city last spring.
Morghese stared back. She remembered none of that, except that now, dim and distant, she did. Lady Elorian? She said slowly. Lady Aemlyn and Lord Luan? More strong houses. More houses that had been behind her before she gained the throne.
Exiled, Lini replied just as slowly. You had Elorian flogged for demanding to know why.
She bent to brush Morghese's hair back, gnarled fingers lingering on her cheek as they had when she checked for fever.
Are you well, girl?
Morgaze nodded dully, but it was because she was remembering, in a shadowy way. Elorian, screaming in outrage as her gown was ripped down the back. House Tremaine had been the very first to throw its support to Trecond, brought by a plumply pretty woman only a few years older than Morgaze. Brought by Elorian, now one of her closest friends. At least she had been. Elaine had been named after Elorian's grandmother. Vaguely, she could recall others leaving the city. Distancing themselves from her, it seemed obvious now. And those who remained? Houses too weak to be of any use, or else sycophants. She seemed to recall signing numerous documents Gabriel had laid in front of her, creating new titles. Gabriel's toad-eaters and her enemies. They were all she could count on being strong in Camelin.
"I do not care what you say," Lini said firmly. "You have no fever, but there's something wrong. You need an Aes Sedai healer is what you need.